I'd call Senate Resource Committee to order. It's February 28th, 3:35. Members present is Senator Stevens, Senator Stedman, Senator Elton, Senator Dyson, and myself, Senator Wagoner. Anybody else in the audience? No. This is the second day of our stakeholders meeting. Today is the here from ExxonMobil, British Petroleum. First company is ExxonMobil. Representatives are Richard Owens, Marty Massey, and Dan Seckers. Welcome, gentlemen. Richard, you going to lead off?
Yeah, I will. Thank you. Okay. And I'll introduce Marty and Dan as well. I am the production manager for ExxonMobil and in Alaska, and vice president of ExxonMobil Alaska Production. And Marty Massey alongside me is the joint interest manager for the U.S. And he is also leading our Alaska Gas Pipeline project fiscal contract negotiations. And next to him is, as you said, Dan Seckers. He is our tax counsel responsible for Alaska. We are here today at your request to offer ExxonMobil's thoughts and concerns on Senate Bill 305. And that's the administration's petroleum profits tax, which I'm going to refer to as PPT as we go through our testimony. If this measure was simply a tax increase, ExxonMobil would actively oppose it. At current prices, we expect ExxonMobil's production tax payments would increase by $50 to $100 million per year. However, we're prepared to move forward under the proposed system since it balances revenues to the state and producers across a range of oil prices, provides incentives for new investment, and includes a transition provision for recent investments. Most importantly for ExxonMobil, the PPT proposal provides a predictable and durable tax system which, along with the appropriate gas pipeline fiscal contract terms, will allow Alaska Natural Gas Pipeline Project to move forward to the next phase. As far as specific concerns about the bill, they center around whether the high tax rate and resulting increase in taxes will hinder the full development of the remaining oil resources on the North Slope. I'll expand on this concern during my testimony. Before I make further comment on the PPT bill, I would like to give a brief overview of ExxonMobil's presence in Alaska and review how the current ELF system has benefited both the industry and the state of Alaska. ExxonMobil has had a presence in Alaska for over a century, investing more than $11 billion in the state's economy. Our activities date back to 1954, when we conducted a comprehensive study of the territory's oil and gas potential. Over the years, we've explored most of the major hydrocarbon plays in Alaska, including the Gulf of Alaska, the St. George and Navarin Basins, the Norton Sound, Beaufort Sea, Cook Inlet, and of course the North Slope, where we were a participant in the 1968 Prudhoe Bay State No. 1 discovery well. We're proud of the role our company has played in Alaska through exploration, initial field developments, construction of taps, development of new technology, and the promotion of efficient reservoir management practices. Currently, ExxonMobil has working interests in Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, Endicott, and Granite Point. We're the operator of the Point Thompson unit. We're the largest interest holder in the Prudhoe Bay field. Our current working interest production is approximately 180,000 barrels a day, and we're the largest owner of discovered gas resource. Our production from Alaska represents approximately 4% of ExxonMobil's worldwide oil and gas production. Our Alaskan production is primarily from Prudhoe Bay and the nearby satellite fields. Prudhoe Bay, along with Point Thompson, has significant remaining potential, but it comes at higher cost and risk.
Excuse me just a minute, Richard. I'd just like the record to reflect that we've been joined by Senator Seekins.
Okay.
He was here.
Well, one of ExxonMobil's objectives in both the gas pipeline fiscal contract negotiations and the debate on oil taxes has been to reduce the risk associated with fiscal changes by working with the state of Alaska to establish a predictable and durable fiscal environment in which to make long-term investment decisions. To that end, any change in the fiscal regime for oil has a direct impact on how we view the stability of the Alaskan fiscal environment. which in turn impacts how we evaluate ongoing investment decisions. And we understand the state's desire to obtain additional tax revenue at higher prices. One of the most challenging tasks that the legislature can undertake is how to change the oil tax system without damaging the industry. As Governor Murkowski has correctly stated on many occasions, the North Slope is one of the most expensive places in which industry operates. Tax systems need to be carefully designed to ensure that the desired objectives are achieved and that any change does not result in unintended consequences, such as reduced investments or lower reserve recovery. One of the many questions that we're asked is why are ExxonMobil and other producers seeking durability and predictability for oil in parallel with negotiating a fiscal contract for a gas pipeline? The answer is fairly simple. The gas on the North Slope is contained in the same reservoirs as the oil and is produced through the same facilities. For a gas project to be viable, we need the fields that produce both oil and gas to be viable, underpinned by predictable and durable fiscal terms. A commitment of billions of dollars to build a natural gas pipeline requires confidence that the base oil business will remain healthy for the long term. With that context in mind, I'd just like to make a few comments about the current oil production severance tax system, the economic limit factor, or ELF, and in particular, how it's been effective at encouraging investment and mitigating production decline. The ELF was designed to allow the state to increase production taxes while not stifling investment in marginal fields. The ELF scaled down the production tax when a field became more marginal, reducing the economic limit to which the field could be produced and ultimately allowing more reserves to be recovered. The 1989 ELF amendment significantly increased the production tax on Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, while providing an incentive to encourage the development of smaller satellites. That 1989 amendment worked as intended, and many small and marginal fields came on stream over the past 17 years. The ELF lowered the tax rate on those fields, supporting their commercial viability. Now, while we would like to have more Prudhoe Bays and Kuparuks, we and the rest of industry haven't found any. Consequently, the focus for the past 10 years has been on the development of these smaller satellite fields. Now, satellites are generally not economic as standalone developments, and have required both new technology and connection to existing infrastructure to be commercially viable. Many of these fields produce viscous oil contained in lower quality reservoirs requiring significantly higher costs, which adds to the risks of development. This is especially true for Polaris and Orion viscous oil developments, with oil that flows more like molasses than oil. Developing these fields has required new technology, more expensive drilling and completion techniques, new production handling equipment, and extensive modifications to existing facilities to process these viscous production streams. Since 2000, ExxonMobil has invested over $250 million in engineering, drilling, and construction of associated facilities for the development of Aurora, Borealis, Midnight Sun, Polaris, and Orion. Significant additional capital is required over the next several years to fully develop these resources. These fields are mitigating the decline of oil production on the North Slope, contributing 50,000 barrels a day and expected to recover over 500 million barrels. Under the ELF formula, many of these smaller satellite fields paid little or no production tax. Even though these fields were paying little production tax, they did and continue to contribute substantial amounts to the state in royalties, property taxes, and income taxes, and in jobs for Alaskans. Over the past 5 years, we and the other working interest owners have also extended the primary Prudhoe Bay enhanced oil recovery technology to some of these satellite fields. Since 1998, ExxonMobil has invested over $30 million in tertiary recovery projects at Point McIntyre, Eileen West End, and Borealis, which are expected to produce an additional 60 million barrels. While tertiary projects recover additional oil, the production profile results in a slower oil recovery and longer payout periods. These satellite enhanced oil recovery projects are in their early stages of development. The major investments have been made, but the oil production benefits will not be received until many years out. The ELF provisions of the existing production severance tax made these economically challenged projects commercially viable. Taken together, the recent Prudhoe Bay satellites and enhanced oil recovery development projects developed over 560 million barrels, and while the resulting state's production tax under ELF was relatively minor, the state's royalty oil would total 70 million barrels, which at today's oil price is worth roughly $4 billion. The bottom line is that the ELF system has worked well for industry and for the state of Alaska by encouraging significant new investment. However, it's also recognized that ELF can be considered a somewhat regressive system in that it does not reflect the profitability or cost in the division of gross revenues between the state and the producers as oil prices rise and fall. And the assumption that a well is marginal at 300 barrels of oil per day does not necessarily hold in the current high oil price environment. Yet this assumption typically contributes to a reduced ELF factor based on the current formula. As a global oil and gas producer, ExxonMobil operates across a wide array of fiscal systems. It is most important that the system recognizes the quality of the resource so that the potential developments will be commercially viable and attract capital. And when I say the quality of the resource, I mean the size and the nature of the oil and gas reservoirs, the cost and technology required to develop those reservoirs, the distance to the market, as well as the tax and royalty system that applies, including the long-term stability of that system. Countries that are experiencing significant industry investment have achieved the proper balance in their fiscal regimes. ExxonMobil's assessment of the remaining oil resource suggests future growth opportunities will come from complex enhanced oil recovery projects, development of smaller, more marginal oil accumulations, and the innovative development of viscous and heavy oil resources. These opportunities will require the development and application of new technology, higher unit development costs, and more complex operations to deliver a given production rate. These resources are much lower in quality as compared to Prudhoe Bay and Kuparuk, though they do face the similar challenges associated with Arctic conditions and the distance to market. Therefore, as stated earlier, we're concerned that the administration's proposal is weighted towards a higher tax, which may prevent some of Alaska's challenged resources from being developed. Now, I'd like to make some comments on the administration's PPT proposal. This proposal represents a tax based on profits, which results in a sharing of the risks and rewards across a range of prices. The state will receive a higher share of revenues when prices are high and will accept lower taxes during periods of low price. The proposal moves from a regressive ELF system to a progressive system. ExxonMobil affiliates have significant experience in profit-based progressive systems around the world, and they work well as long as they've properly taken into account the nature of the resource base, which I mentioned earlier. Now let me just discuss a few of the features of the PPT proposal. This bill represents a major step change in Alaska's current production tax system. The bill appropriately addresses this step change by including a transition plan so that recent investment decisions are not adversely impacted. The bill provides a transition allowance over the next 6 years based on capital investments made over the last 5 years. We believe this transition plan is appropriate because the benefits from these recent investments have not yet been fully received. Oil and gas companies invest large sums of money years ahead of first production and were at risk of price, development cost, production rates, and ultimate reserve recovery. In many cases, it takes many years, often more than 5 years, for the return on oil and gas investment to occur. For example, satellite and tertiary recovery investment decisions made during the last 5 years were made under the ELF structure, anticipating a lower tax relative to that proposed under the PPT bill. The state appropriately provided this incentive, the ELF, so that these challenged and costly projects could be made commercially viable. It's not appropriate to suddenly increase the taxes on these investments without providing some form of consideration. The transition provisions recognise that past investments were made under the ELF structure and somewhat reduces the increased tax treatment to which these projects will now be subjected. To avoid penalising these recent investments, the transition provisions included in this bill are essential. As I've said, we're also concerned at the 20% tax.
Richard, can I stop you there?
Yeah.
You know, this has been a kind of a phase of that we've asked each company about. What are some examples of where these, when you have a change in taxation, whether it be Texas or in Canada or someplace else in the world, where you have these transition provisions?
Okay.
What other examples can you guys give us of this happening and how it's happened in other regimes?
Chairman Wagner, I'll let Dan Sickers address that question.
Senator, through the chair, I can't speak to any foreign at the moment, but I can tell you we can point as an example to our own federal government. For example, back in 1975, when under the Tax Reform Act, they repealed percentage depletion for all the integrated oil companies. But they provided in there some legislation where it allowed, if you had fixed contracts, that you were able to continue to use percentage depletion for the duration of that contract. So they recognized that when you entered in these long-term fixed sale contracts, that you entered in them with the understanding of the economics you were going to get using percentage depletion, the federal government allowed you to continue to use those rates. Another example that comes to mind would be investment tax credits. When the investment tax credit was repealed back by the federal government back in the 1980s, they didn't. If you had an investment that was allowed to recover investments, say, over 5 years, and they changed the law, say, in the third year, they didn't say it stopped. You were able to continue to claim that investment tax credit, just additional investments were no longer eligible for foreign tax credits. When they changed depreciation rules, they didn't go back and say that that the rate in which that asset was allowed to be recovered under the depreciation rules in place changed. Future investment got that longer or more less favorable depreciation, but the current rule stayed in place. So those are just some examples of where a transitional allowance of prior investment continued after the rules have been changed just by the federal government alone.
Thank you. Mr. Senator Stedman.
If I could, I don't think the answer to the question. With the oil industry around the world, in what countries have these provisions been used?
Let me just say that many of the places that, through the chair, many of the places where we operate around the world, we actually have production sharing contracts or production contracts. And so in a number of times where you see those tax systems change, those changes don't actually flow to us because we're covered by contracts. But the question was also asked in the House committee, and we said that we would look at whether we could find any specific examples of this type of transition arrangement.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chairman?
Oh, Senator Stevens, I'm sorry.
So thank you. Mr. Owen, you said that in many regions around the world you operate under production sharing contracts and the terms of those contracts, and those terms are your tax and severance and royalty payments are locked in for a period of time? And so that any modification doesn't apply to you? Is that the way I understood that?
Through the chair, yeah, that's correct, Senator Stevens. In fact, most of those contracts, it's a single government take type figure. It's you could imagine it's built up by severance tax, royalty, and income tax. But yeah, it's a contractual arrangement. Doesn't change over time.
It doesn't change over time. And what's the length of time under those typical contracts?
Through the chair, Senator Stevens, they vary across the board. Largely depends on the quality of the resource and the life that's taken into account under what's being developed. But you'll see things from 50 to 60 years. Some of them are written for the particular block that's in question. for the entirety until you produced every barrel out of that block is you know, is associated with the contract. So it varies across the board.
Senator Stevens.
So if I understand this correctly, the contractual terms that are entered in prior to initiation or production are locked in during the term of the life of that contract?
Through the chair, that's right, yes.
Thank you.
Any questions? Senator Stevens.
Just one additional one on reopeners. Is there reopeners as a standard clause in those contracts? And I'm not, what we're talking about here is the legislation in front of us, not any other types of legislation.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, as you can imagine, there's various contracts around the world with many, many different, you know, clauses in them that relate to reopeners and not reopeners. I can't give you a percentage in terms of, you know, what might have reopeners in them or not. They just vary. They vary across the board in terms of what was negotiated at that particular point in time for that particular asset. What was done to, you know, allow the investment to go forward.
Senator Seacombs.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So some of those reopeners, I think, are called revolutions, Senator Stedman. Regime changes. But the let me see if I understand this correctly. Basically, I've been looking at how this came down. It says, you guys are basically telling me, I made this investment decision when I knew the severance tax was going to be an average of 7%. I mean, based on ELF or however it came down. Now we're going to go to 14.5% with the 2020 program, roughly. That's a rough approximation from what I've heard. So for the next, I'd like to have some consideration for that. I'm not entitled to it under any government program. It isn't that I'm going to lose some of my other standard deductions in either state or federal income tax. It's just good faith. You're saying I made this decision believing that my economic return was here, so now I'd like some consideration for a transition period. It's nothing entitled. It's for consideration for that prior investment. Am I correct?
Senator Seacombs, through the chair. Yeah, that is correct. What we're really saying has been a step change in the tax on the revenue stream that's coming from those investments. And so that what you said is exactly right. This is just a mechanism by which to achieve some consideration during that, because some of those investments, when you talk about averages, and averages can be deceptive, some of those are going to be made in fields which may have been paying no production tax, which are now going to be paying 20% production tax. And part of this is just about this underlying, you know, the health and the how we view the investment climate. Are we going to regret some of those investments that were made, and what's the future look like? And I think that this is just trying to get a transition plan so that when we get this step change, we can move through over the next 5 years, we can move from one tax regime to another tax regime.
And if I could, Mr. Chairman, you won't regret it as much as if it stays at $60 plus a barrel as if it would if it declined to what more people are predicting would be the long-term rate.
Yeah, Senator Seacombs, through the chair, I mean, that's quite right. We're currently in a period of quite high prices, and when we went into those investments, price was one of the risks and that we were looking at.
Right.
Changes in the tax structure was one that we weren't as focused on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you.
Further questions? Thanks.
As I said, we're also concerned about the 20% tax rate as proposed, and whether or not that will support the growth opportunities remaining on the North Slope, which I described as primarily complex enhanced oil recovery projects, the development of small oil accumulations, and the innovative development of viscous and heavy oil. These opportunities have challenged economics, and with investment credits of 20%, while the investment credits of 20% will enhance the present value economics of new investments, the 20% tax rate will result in a lower overall cash flow. The impact on all of the economic parameters must be carefully weighed before a decision to progress an investment is made. The combination of a 20% credit along with the 20% tax rate, may not be adequate to support the development of all of the remaining opportunities. It's with this in mind that we strongly recommend that the legislature not increase the proposed tax rate or reduce the proposed tax credits. This bill also addresses many of the long-standing issues that have divided the state and the industry over the years. For example, too many years and too much money have been spent in disputes over how to value a single barrel of crude oil or a single molecule of gas. It made little sense in the past and makes little sense today for the state to have separate divisions determining the value of oil and gas, one for royalty and one for taxes. There is only one value in the marketplace. Senate Bill 305 allows the state to value a producer's oil and gas using the producer's royalty settlement agreement, which was negotiated with and approved by the Department of Natural Resources. This will provide certainty to a producer on the value on which to pay its royalty and production taxes and will reduce the administrative and audit costs to both the state and industry. Under current prices, ExxonMobil and industry will pay more in taxes as compared with the current production tax system. However, as I said in my opening comments, we need predictability and durability under which to gauge investment decisions. No one wants to invest money in a project only to have the rules changed, reducing the attractiveness of that investment. The transition provision is an important feature of the bill necessary to provide relief for the abrupt change caused by the new PPT system. The administration decided to weight the proposal to a higher tax, which may make it difficult to progress the remaining future development opportunities. It's most important that the quality of the resource be factored into the design of the tax system. Given our view of the resources, we would not support a higher tax rate or lower credits than proposed in this bill. Senate Bill 305 seeks to balance revenues to the state and the producers across a range of oil prices and provides incentives for new investments, which is a clear objective of the state of Alaska. And most importantly for ExxonMobil, we believe the new system, coupled with appropriate gas pipeline fiscal contract terms, will lead to a predictable and durable tax system, which will enable the Alaska Gas Project to move forward to the next phase. Potential changes in the features of the PPT bill must be carefully considered to avoid upsetting the balance contained within the bill. In conclusion, this bill is important for Alaska and the producers. It's one part, a very important part, of a series of related issues that the legislature will need to address to ultimately provide the necessary fiscal environment to stimulate oil production and to progress the Alaska Gas Pipeline Project. The fiscal contract that is being finalized under the authority of the Stranded Gas Development Act will incorporate this PPT legislation by reference in order to provide fiscal stability. We are currently working with the administration on how best to incorporate this bill into the fiscal contract. The fiscal contract will soon be released for public and legislative comment. Following the regular session, we understand the governor will call a special session so the legislature can vote on the contract. For that reason, it is important that Senate Bill 305 be enacted in its present form prior to that special session. ExxonMobil has been in Alaska for 50 years. Our future business plan shows our continued activity in Alaska for at least the next 50 years. And we're on the verge of taking the next step to commercialize Alaska's North Slope gas. And I ask you to support the administration's efforts in this regard. Thank you, Senator Wagner and committee, and for the opportunity to testify, and we're happy to address any questions.
Thank you. I've got one question on the on page 11. You talked about, given our view of the resources, we not support a higher tax rate or lower credits than proposed in the bill. We've had a lot of discussions with various people. Would you support a higher credit rate?
Well, at the moment, Senator Wagner, the way we've looked at this is that we've analyzed this and we can understand the balance that's been created in this bill between the tax rate, the credit rate, some of the other provisions, and the transition arrangement. And we are able to move forward with this bill as proposed. If there were higher tax credits, that would change this bill, and we would need to see what the impact of that was in its entirety, or whether, so it's hard to sort of say, but in general, Yeah, incentives help investment. So higher tax credits remove some of the barriers for investment. It depends on what else that involves and what other changes. But
it's not a trap.
I know.
I just wanted to ask the question.
High tax credits help.
So. Because some people said we haven't got tax credits high enough. So I just wanted to ask that question. Other questions? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's quite a, regardless of what's coming after this session, this piece of legislation, I think, Mr. Chairman, needs to stand the test of time in and on itself. And there's been a lot of discussion on predictability and durability of the tax regime for the people in this, doing business in the state. And my understanding is that this new proposal is regressive, as mentioned earlier, and is progressive, as mentioned earlier, and the royalty and property taxes are regressive, and together they're fairly neutral, as far as there's not a lot of progressivity in it, or regressivity in total, and I was wondering if we could have some comments on that.
Senator Stedman, through the chair. I would just restate that at the moment, you know, we have analyzed this bill and we see the balance within this bill. Clearly, there are other models that could be pursued with different changes and step changes or around price, and all of those would again, you know, depending on the proposal, we'd need to look at whatever that is and see whether that still provided the same sort of balance in this bill and and the right sort of investment climate.
Senator Stedman?
If I could, maybe I'd botched up asking the question, Mr. Chairman. So let me coin it another way. If we're going to have a tax regime in place for a decade or two decades or three decades or however long it is, as long as the structure is fair to both parties, there's really no need to come back and do a lot of adjustments, regardless of what tax issue we're working on. And to have a system that is fair for both parties, because no one knows what the future price is going to be. Could be $20 a barrel, could be $120 a barrel. Do you feel that it's in the long run best interest of both parties to have a system that would not put one party or the other in a disadvantage in the long run?
Senator Stedman, through the chair. Yeah, I would agree. I think that for durability and predictability of the system that we're looking for, we want a system that is viewed as fair and equitable by all parties. And I think that we're at a point where everyone is looking at this system, which is a tax on profits, which is therefore a balance of risk and reward. And I think everyone's looking at it across a wide range of prices to see whether they believe it achieves that end. And I think that's something the legislature needs to do as well.
Senator Alden.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, and thanks, Mr. Rowan, for the presentation. And I appreciate it. I know it's sometimes difficult to be invited to participate as a stakeholder in discussions like this. So I appreciate your being here. For me, some of the comments that were made in your conclusion are issues that I've struggled with. For example, you talk about what we do now with the oil tax will enable the Alaska Gas Project to move forward to the next phase. And we don't know what the next phase is on this side of the table. You mentioned that we need to address ultimately and provide the necessary fiscal environment to stimulate oil production and to progress the Alaska gas pipeline. And then you say we are currently working with the administration on how to best incorporate this bill into the fiscal contract. I mean, I hear that, and this is maybe more of a comment that I'd like you to respond to. We hear that, and I feel sometimes when we're talking about the oil tax and I hear things like this, I feel like, okay, I'm being asked to make a decision that will do all of this without knowing what plan B is. I mean, if the oil tax is plan A, It's difficult for me to agree that I can come to a good decision on an oil tax when I don't know what Plan B is. And so that compels me to look at this, as we've been advised to do, as a standalone issue, because we can't predicate the oil tax bill on a gas pipeline contract that may or may not come. And if it does come, that may or may not have elements that we know about yet. And how do you respond to that? I mean, wouldn't you prefer that we just consider an oil tax that works, that you can then, I mean, you say you're now working with the administration on incorporating this, but wouldn't you rather have an oil tax that works and then just have it rolled into a gas pipeline contract?
Senator Johnson, through the chair, I think you're exactly right in terms of, you know, you need to look at this tax as a standalone tax, and will it result in a healthy oil business? Will it do what you want it to do for the state of Alaska in terms of encouraging investment and allow these remaining development opportunities in the state of Alaska to come on stream? What we want to communicate with you is that as part of the gas pipeline fiscal contract negotiations, we believe this bill, if incorporated in the contract, will provide the predictability and durability we need, you know, to advance to the next phase of the gas pipeline project. And I know at this point in time, many of you don't have the terms and so forth in terms of what we've negotiated with the fiscal contract. And I'm hopeful within the next couple of weeks here, we're able to, for everyone to, you know, see what the gas pipeline contract terms look like. But I think you're doing it just right. You're trying to determine what's the right oil bill to, you know, for the state of Alaska in terms of encouraging the right oil business. We felt it was important that you understood our position on the oil taxes relative to what's being proposed, in terms of how it impacts the fiscal contract. And that was the reason for our comments.
Just follow up, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Massey, I appreciate that. And I want to make sure that I understand what you're saying. So, for example, in the summary comments that Mr. Owen gave us, where he said, we are currently working with the administration on how best to incorporate this bill into the contract. I mean, you're not then suggesting that it's this bill, and if it's another bill, or if changes are made to this bill, you're not suggesting that you're not suggesting that you don't see a contract, are you, for a pipeline, gas pipeline?
I'm sorry, I'm not sure I understood the question.
I'm not sure I asked it in a clear and concise way, but through the comments, you say this bill is necessary to move forward to the next phase.
Yep.
You say this bill is necessary to establish the fiscal environment to stimulate oil production and progress the gas pipeline contract. You say that you're now working with the administration on how best to incorporate this bill into a future contract. You're not suggesting that if it's not this bill, you're not suggesting that the gas pipeline contract is delayed out into the distant future, are you?
Yep. I think I understand where you're headed, and let me just say that we believe this bill provides what we need on the oil side to allow the gas pipeline project to go. Now, if this bill is changed in some way, then we will have to reevaluate whether that is right. But if you do the right things in terms of determining what's best for the oil industry in Alaska, that's going to encourage investment, maintain a healthy oil business, then it's probably going to be okay in the fiscal contract for us. What we need, we're on the verge of, you know, commercializing this gas, going to invest billions of dollars for this thing to go forward. We need to make sure we understand the fiscal regime under which we're going to make those investments, and that's what the comments are trying to direct.
Senator Dyson,
did you mean to imply that if we and the governor had offered you a 30-year contract with the terms under the existing oil tax law that you wouldn't have been able to go forward?
The governor never offered us that, Senator Dyson. So I think he recognized that, you know, the oil tax system needed to be overhauled. There'd been a lot of discussion about changing ELF, the need to change ELF, move to a different system. This is a system that they came up with, PPT, and we tried to see if we could work within that system to get the framework that we needed to make sure we could go forward on the gas pipeline. And that's really what was done.
I think you just said no, and but is there anything that this bill does, particularly on the investment credits, that makes the gas pipeline contract more probable?
Senator Dyson, through the chair, if I understand the question, it was whether there's anything in this bill. It was kind of a very open question, but anything in this bill that will assist the gas pipeline in moving forward? Probably one aspect of it that does help is the credits and how they apply, particularly when we look at the investments that will be required at Point Thompson, which is going to be a major contributor of the gas for a gas pipeline project. I'll leave it there. I think that's probably the key one. Yes, that would help.
Okay. And finally, wouldn't it be clearer to say that this bill is necessary for the gas pipeline contract to go forward if there's a provision that puts stability to the oil tax regime for 20, 30 years?
Again, Senator Dyson, through the chair, yeah, that is exactly what we're saying, and I think we've tried to say it clearly, and if it didn't come across, yeah, we're looking for this bill and then be incorporated by contract provisions
to provide exactly the stability. Right. But it's not just this bill.
Well, this bill provides no stability and no predictability because it could be subject to change, even though we recognize there hasn't been a lot of change in the half of 2005. But this bill doesn't actually provide stability and predictability, but the contract provisions would.
All right. Thank you. I'm clear.
Senator Terrio.
Thank you. Richard, on page 10 of your comments, you talked about the valuation issue, and certainly the state and the companies have argued back and forth over the years over valuations. My understanding, there's different systems. There's one in Department of Revenue, one in DNR, and you specifically referenced the use of the producer's royalty settlement agreement in DNR. It's my understanding that the difference between the valuation methodologies may result in as much as a dollar's difference in valuing the barrel of oil, and this one specifically is the lower of the two or three. Is that price range or suggested price difference between the methodologies correct from your views?
Do you have a call? Okay. Senator Terrio, through the chair. It's my understanding that the small differences do occur in that, mainly due to whether prices are rising and falling, and it's more of a lead lag issue rather than a fundamental issue about the formula itself. So it just depends on where the trend is. That's my understanding of it, but we could find out for you to make certain that that's right.
Mr. Chairman, I think it's one of the little things in the bill that, you know, may actually result in some significant differences to the state that I certainly don't have a real clear understanding, and you know the committee might want to consider the higher of, you know, if there's different methodologies or understand why one would track up and down and why the dollar difference might grow or shrink, and just have a better understanding there. I'm sorry, Richard, I missed part of your comments. Did you offer an opinion on the $73 million tax-free allowance?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, no, I didn't.
Would you like, are you authorized to offer an opinion?
Sure you are.
Certainly. The administration proposed a $73 million allowance or allowable deduction, and We understand why the administration did that. They're trying to address some of the barriers for new entrants into the market, into the, you know, into oil and gas exploration and development. We would say that we have some concerns about whether that's a good thing to do or not in terms of potential for an unlevel playing field where it can skew your view of that next investment if you're partners with someone and someone might see something differently to someone else because it comes into play. But in general, we understand why the administration has included it in this proposal because we would agree that there are barriers to exploration and development in Alaska. It's a high-cost place to do business, and there's high risks involved, too. So our view is it's kind of a policy decision, and the administration is trying to encourage new entrants.
Can I follow up on that? Same thing. I understand the $73 million, how it works. I understand it doesn't make nearly the difference to a major corporation as it does a smaller or mid-sized explorer. Are there not other ways to do that incentive without putting the $73 million floor in there?
Senator Wagner, there probably, well, it depends on what's trying to be achieved. And I think, and this question probably is a question better addressed by the administration. But I think that my understanding of what the administration is trying to achieve is they're trying to address a wide, you know, all geographic areas and things like that. So it's very broad in terms of how they've put it forward.
Let me ask a question different then. Is the $73 million being in this bill going to incentivize your corporation to do any more exploration?
No, the $73 million, Senator Wagner, the $73 million will be, you know, the first deduction, if you like, and it's going to be consumed because of there's just the scale of the business. Exploration will be kind of that next step, and therefore it's not going to come into play in that decision making.
That's what I thought. Thank you. Senator Terrio.
Thank you. With regards to the application of the credits and the look-back provision, BP used one field development that they've got in development right now, and they showed a graph yesterday. In the five-year, and it showed for that particular development, you go back 4 years, a fairly meager investments, but then it spikes up as they really move forward on the particular field. In the five-year look back, as far as your expenditures, are they fairly flat over the 5 years? Are there peaks?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, our expenditures over the last 5 years have been relatively flat. They've been around $180 million a year of capital investment.
Okay.
Can I add something to that? I think it's important that you understand that not only the level of investments, but what sort of things have we been investing in. For example, in Richard's testimony, he talked about really difficult EOR projects in satellite fields that we've started to develop, the viscous fields that we've started to develop. You know, these fields are not as profitable as Prudhoe Bay or Arkopari. And these investments will take a long time to pay out for us to receive the benefits from those investments. And that's one of the reasons, as Richard highlighted in his testimony, why we think this transition provision is important.
I just want to, while he was on that, let me ask one other question. While we're talking about that, if it's 2020 or 2520 or whatever number we arrive at on this bill, what an additional incentive, a separate incentive from additional 5% on the credit side do for viscous oil?
Senator Wagner, an increase in credit will help improve the cash flow, the present value economics of any investment because it represents an ability to offset some of that upfront investment. So higher credits help cash flow economics. So they, not that that's the only parameter, it's not only the present value. We look across a whole range of parameters when we're making decisions. But in general, yeah, credits work that they reduce that the upfront burden, the investment, because you can take that offset against existing production. So yeah, they help incentivize challenged investment opportunities.
Or producing molasses, as you might say.
Yeah. But I would reiterate that, you know, what's important is the balance in that equation, because the tax rate takes a lot of cash out of the project. So there's an investment side where you're reducing some of the upfront costs, which helps the present value economics. But when you look at the overall investment, the higher tax rate takes a lot of cash out of the project.
Secretary.
Back on the investments, you said about $180 million a year. Looking forward and taking out perhaps what might happen as far as developing gas infrastructure to deliver product to a pipeline, what do you think your company's investments likely to be, and does this level of credit direct you or incent you to actually spend additional dollars? Again, set aside potential development of infrastructure to develop, deliver to a gas pipeline. I guess one of the things we're trying to do is incent investment here, and we're not quite sure what level of incentive company to company really or causes you to change your decision making.
Senator, through the chair, I think that it's very complex discussion around investment opportunities to just talk about yes, no type answer. In my testimony, we talked about when we're looking at, there's a whole range of resource opportunities out there, and some of them are more challenged than others. We also look over a whole range of investment parameters, that when we're looking at the quality of an investment and whether whether it's commercially viable or not. I guess the question is whether a higher credit, is that the question? I was really around whether a particular number would be the right credit for incentivizing. At this stage, we would say that we are projecting similar sorts of near-term investments. We're clearly going to want to be spending more money as we get into into a gas project and things like that. But we are concerned that the tax rate that's being proposed at the moment and the credit rate, that combination may not allow us to develop all of the resource on the North Slope. So it kind of depends, are you talking about the next best investment on the North Slope, or is it the most challenged investment? And we're worried about those challenged investments at this kind of tax rate.
Okay.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. We've been told by several of the consultants that the industry looks at, you know, the industry take and the government take, and they don't really differentiate on the government take if it's a royalty or a property tax or a crypto tax or any other type of taxes. It's virtually cash flow that's gone to the government side, and then the industry looks at, you know, what is coming to the industry. Is that accurate, or is the industry, or are they a little sensitive to how the government take is sliced up?
Senator Stedman, through the chair. Yeah, I think in most of the investment economics we're looking at, we're mainly focused on what our return is, and less focused on how the government take might be divided up. So I don't know whether you have any. We're basically focused on what dollars are we investing and what dollars are flowing back, recognizing that government take is government take. It could be going to numerous different places. We don't really analyze investments as to where those government take dollars are going.
I would add to that, if you look across the globe, you'll find varying levels of take for different basins that people operate in. And there's a good reason for that. The reason is they look at the quality of the resource that is within that basin, and what government take you know, can we extract from that and still cause an investor to come in here and attract, you know, attract capital? So you see a wide range around those. And the, as Richard said in his testimony, the countries that are, you see a lot of investment activity in today, they got that balance about right. And what we're concerned about with the bill is that, you know, is the balance right? Given the resources that we see on the North Slope, is the total government take too high to really make those go? That's what we're concerned about.
Senator Stebbins.
I have a follow-up. One of the things that we're going to have more debate on around the table and struggle with is the comparative universe, recognizing that Alaska is pretty unique, this high cost and Arctic environment. And we've had consultants come in and, you know, show us comparisons, and other consultants come in with different comparisons, and some of us are worried about, you know, do we really have anything to compare to? Are we that unique? And how unique, in your opinion, is Alaska?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I mean, I think that's exactly the issue we've been trying to raise through our testimony, is that the tax system that Alaska needs to put in place is a tax system that works for the resource base in Alaska. And I would probably agree that I think a lot of the consultant reports and comments that have been made have not so much focused on the resource base that's in Alaska, but have more looked at just comparison data, comparative data from existing databases and things like that. And it is really that if we're, you know, we've now looked at it and we think that this equation is balanced, although we're concerned that it may not develop all of the resource, but that is at the heart of the question, is the resources are becoming more unique, if you like. If you look at it, we've developed two very large oil fields, Kuparuk and Prudhoe Bay, and the remaining resources are, you know, challenged opportunities. They are enhanced oil opportunities. They're, you know, viscous and heavy oil. There's small accumulations on, in a harsh, high-risk environment.
Can I just ask one follow-up?
Senator Stebbins.
And I'll let someone else have some questions. Cause, but one of the, well, Great Britain comes up a lot, North Sea, Norway, you know, as a comparison, and is that just a, you know, another rabbit trail, or is it, or should we be, you know, in your opinion, paying attention to that? Because what we're trying to do as policymakers is strike a balance. Clearly, we want the oil industry to stay here, and we want you to expand. I mean, we've got the same general goals. I would think you guys would like to expand and prosper along with everybody else. So, I mean, I'm not trying to load questions or steer you. I'm just trying to get, you know, we've had a lot of presentations, and it's nice to hear from the industry, and I feel a real hesitation from you guys to just shoot information at us.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I think that what we're all struggling with is, yeah, there's always data that's on the other side, and if you look at almost all of the reports and the data that's being shared with the legislature so far and our own data, you can find systems where with higher government take or lower government take, and you can find some of those with lower government take that are struggling, and you can find some with higher government take that are doing well. And it comes back to, they've actually found the right balance between their tax system and their resources. And so if you're asking, is Norway and the UK, are they good examples? All I think is that all they're going to be is data points on that spectrum between whatever you want to say, 40% government take and 80% government take. What we really need is what's the right system that's going to work for Alaska. And so if you're asking me, should you do more comparative studies with overseas, I'm not sure that's going to help you in those deliberations.
I think we already have stacks of that. So.
Yeah.
We don't have enough books. Senator Elden.
Thanks, and Mr. Owen. You've been asked questions, and I've listened closely to the answers about the incentives to explore or develop or produce that are envisioned in this bill. And we talk about we talk about the credits, but we haven't yet talked about a very unique feature of this, which is the tradability of the credits. And so I'd like to ask a two-part question. From your perspective as a major producer on the North Slope, I mean, does the tradability of the credits make this a better bill than if they weren't there? And then I'd ask you to put yourself in the shoes of a smaller company that may be interested just in exploration and not production, and if you could tell me what you think their perspective would be on the tradability of the credits.
Senator Elton, through the chair, I mean, I think that the tradability is an important feature of the bill, because I think that it's not that we would be wanting, we'd be hopeful that we're not in a position where we're actually selling credits. We'd hope we have the production and the to offset in the revenue to offset those. But I think when you look at what the whole incentivization and providing credits for new investments, I think it's a particularly important aspect of it for the independents and the explorers, so they can monetize those credits as they go along. Otherwise, they really do not get the present value impact of those outlays and that incentive. It means they would then hold them until they actually had offsetting production. So while it's probably less important for larger companies with lots of assets, for the smaller companies, I think it's going to be extremely important that they have tradable credits.
Further questions? Seeing no further questions, gentlemen, thank you for your presentation. Thank you for coming and being with us today. We're going to just have a brief recess. Do you have any more? Excuse me, just.
I'm sorry, I did.
We were almost out.
Chairman, I was after the bell.
Senator Terrio, we fight dirty sometimes.
Senator Stedman had asked some questions about the stability of the system and whether this, hopefully getting to something that the system itself, at low prices, high prices, treats both parties fairly so that the system itself doesn't lead to the destabilization, so that one side or another feels like it's not working for them, and either drives investment away, or there's pressure from the constituency to impose an additional tax or change the tax. It's what we're experiencing right now with the ELF system. And it's my understanding that in the back and forth with the administration, a proposal was advanced from the companies, I'm not sure exactly where, that was progressive with regards to price. And I'm wondering if you, and Senator Stedman's questions were sort of leading that direction, but I'm just wondering what opinion you have to a system that, because what we've got here is just a flat 20%, regardless of what the price is. And at very high prices, and what was not anticipated with ELF is running through today's current prices. You know, there's this clamoring that it's not fair to one side. So whatever we come up with, we should run some high prices and some low prices through to see that the system can accommodate that without being destabilizing.
Yes, Senator Terrio, through the chair, I think we kind of talked about this a little earlier. But yeah, we would certainly agree that we're after a system that will create a healthy industry that is fair to all parties at a range of prices. And the profit tax, petroleum profits tax type system, is a sharing of risk and reward. So on the first point, we would definitely agree that the legislature needs to review this over a wide range of prices to make sure that it does meet the needs of both parties. On the other question of increased progressivity and either price tiers and things like that, those concepts have been discussed. That isn't the in this proposed bill from the administration. At this stage, we would just reiterate that we've looked at this proposal, and we see that while we've got the concerns whether we've developed the whole resource, that it enables us to move forward towards predictability and durability. If there was another proposal and there, you know, there are other ways of doing this, we would need to relook at that and see whether it still would result in a healthy industry and allow us to move forward with predictability and durability as well.
Thank you. And on the issue of the credits, since you've been discussing this for some time with the administration, have you looked at the constitutionality under the U.S. Constitution of the allowance of tax incentives or incentives of that nature? There's a case currently going before the U.S. Supreme Court, Kuno versus Daimler Chrysler in Ohio. And have you reviewed that in particular? Because that case, the outcome of that case, could set the tax incentives all across the nation, turn it on its head. And I know the case is out there. I don't know a lot of the particulars. Have you reviewed that?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, no, I'm not aware of it, and I haven't reviewed it. I'll turn to my tax counsel, and are you aware of it, Dan?
I'm not that familiar with the case of the chair, but we can take a look at that.
Okay. Another issue that's come up is the issue of demobilization or shutdown costs and how they're treated under this proposal. And in talking to one of our consultants, they said, well, you know, looking for exploration, development, production, and shutdown, that's all the cost of the life of a field and what's incurred, costs that are incurred in developing oil. But I believe the way that the bill is struck right now is, you know, costs for shut-in or removal of facilities that have been in place for 30 years would be allowed against this production tax from this point going forward. And I'm not sure the legitimacy of something where you know, have accounted for internally in your operations or set aside money or whatever over a long period of time for a particular well, particular production facility, that would now be credited against this production tax at this point, or dragging all those billions of dollars of potential expense forward to the point where production starts going down naturally because the resource is not infinite. So the revenue that we're generating potentially starts going down. You then start removing facilities, shutting down, so those costs all come due. And we get to a point where we've got some production, but we have absolutely no revenue coming in off the PPT because it's all being expensed back on shutdown costs.
Yeah, Senator Terrio, through the chair, yeah, it's my understanding of the bill and that it covers lease expenditures. And so to the extent you had abandonment costs, things like that, as they were incurred, they would flow through lease expenditures, and they would be a deduction for the PPT. Now, that's distinct from reserves, which are usually done as book entries and things like where you're creating a reserve, but you haven't actually spent the money. So it's a cash model, so it's based on what cash expenses you have on your lease is what becomes the deduction for PPT.
But do you see any legitimacy of differentiating between, certainly between facilities that you would put in place under PPT, yeah, new facilities, okay, versus all of that old infrastructure that's been in production for, you know, 30 years?
Thank you. Senator Terrio, through the chair. The way I would look at that is, you know, we're trying to put a system in place that's going to be here for many, many years, you know, with the PPT system, and are talking about how do we include that in the fiscal contract on gas. So, you know, I think we can look forward and say we're really not anticipating major abandonment opportunity, you know, costs for years and years ahead. We will be paying tax under this system, you know, 30, 40, 50 years. You know, at the point in time where investments are, you know, for abandonment would occur. So it seemed to me that, yeah, it would be appropriate, given the long time that we're going to put this tax in place and pay tax under this bill, would be appropriate for those investments to come against it.
Just one point about that. We have some fields that are much older and more mature than your fields, but we are very concerned about the immediate future, though, of those expenditures. I think that's part of the reason Senator Terrio asked that question.
I see.
In Cook Inlet, for instance, we have, I believe, 4 platforms that are currently shut in and are basically unmanned this time. So whether they stay that way now with this new system.
Yeah, my comments were primarily directed to, you know, Prudhoe and those places where those fields are going to be there for a long time.
Yeah. And I think you have a small operation on the Cook Inlet that may somewhere in the future be a little more prone to being shut in than your North Slope operation, don't you?
Yeah, we have, Senator Wagner, we have Granite Point in the Cook Inlet that we have a 75% interest in.
Okay. Senator Elton.
On the same point, thank you, Mr. Chair. On the same point, I mean, I'm trying to make sure that I understand this fully. And if I understood Mr. Massey's testimony, he thought it might be appropriate that the and I'm not sure I'm using terms of art, that the demobilization costs would be eligible for a credit. And as I try to understand this, how do you handle the set-asides that you do for demob? I mean, I'm assuming that when you determine net profit, that you're deducting, you know, the money that you're setting aside for demob also. Is that correct?
Senator Elton, through the chair, just the first point, and maybe I might have created the confusion. I don't believe that the abandonment costs will generate a credit. There'll be a lease expenditure, though, so there won't be a credit. There'll just be a deduction for lease expenditures. On the other question about reserves, reserves are usually carried as book entries, and it's not a. And this bill is about really modeling cash. It's about what cash profit is being made versus, or cash revenue versus cash deductions because of lease expenditures versus cash capital investment. It's a cash model.
If I could follow up, Mr. Chair, because I'm not sure I still understand. So I'll try asking in a slightly different way. On the costs or on the accounts that you create to handle future costs for demobilization, are the deposits to that account, are they deducted from gross profit, and is that the way? Are those costs, costs contribute to net profits, or to the level of net profits?
Senator Elton, through the chair, let me try to take this one on. When we talk about set aside, you know, when you report your earnings, you know, through the SEC and so forth, you're required to deduct the amount that it costs to abandon those facilities as they're produced, as you produce those facilities over time relative to the oil production that's being produced at the time. That's what you show in terms of your report, in terms of the earnings that you made in that particular year. That's really book economics. It's not cash flow economics as Richard described, in terms of there isn't money set aside in a cash account, you know, to do that abandonment work. It comes with time as you take the cost of abandonment, and it comes out of your normal cash flow in that given year to make that investment to abandon the facility. So it's a question of book economics versus cash flow economics, as Richard described.
Excuse me. We're holding out
again
now.
Senator through the chair. Again, just to echo that thought, just from a tax point of view as well, for federal income tax purposes, you're not able to expense that abandonment disability or dismantlement charges until you actually incur them. So we wouldn't be able to take a cash expense on a tax return until we actually expend the money, which obviously we wouldn't do until we actually started taking the activity.
So if I could follow this, Mr. Chair. So when the state under PPT determines net profits, the net profits would not include, as I think you call it, a bookend or a, you know, the net profit determination does not include anything that you set aside for future costs on DEMO.
Senator Elton, that's correct. The way it would only include costs which were actually incurred in the field. In other words, real lease expenditures where someone went out and abandoned something and removed it, then that becomes a lease expenditure. Reserves that are set aside have no bearing on the PPT deductions.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Senator Stebbins?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm still having some conceptual challenges here grasping what's going on, because we've got a global industry that's very dynamic, with multiple players in multiple countries, and we've got this place called Alaska that has the industry up here in a world-class oil field and infrastructure, yet we don't have any way of comparing it to any place on the planet to get some kind of comfort range. Are we high, are we low? You know, when the government takes statistics, you know, that the relationship between the industry and the state, and looping the feds too as the state group, but you know, so how does a policymaker try to come up with where the range of comfort is, other than through peer negotiations and then agreement? It'd be like, I mean, it just seems odd, Mr. Chairman, that you wouldn't want to look around the world and see what's going on.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I mean, I think that the you have the resources, and you've got your consultant and the administration's consultant have provided, I think, a pretty large database that shows government take across fairly wide range of countries and different environments. The point that we were making before was that some of those work, and some of them work well, some of them don't work well, and it depends on the resource base. And then you say, well, can I compare my resource base? Well, resource bases are a little bit more complicated and difficult to compare. But what you do have, and I think that the process that's being undergone through these committee hearings is exactly the right process. You're hearing from the administration, from their deliberations on this matter. You're hearing from major oil companies in the state. You're going to hear from independents. You're going to hear from your own consultants as well as the administration's consultants. And all of that, to a large extent, all of that same information is the information that the administration has used to develop this bill that they've sent to the legislature, this proposed bill, this bill. So it's somewhat, our expectation is somewhat that once the legislature goes through those same deliberations, we think that you're going to come to a similar conclusion that, you know, while there are regimes that are lower and regimes that are higher, when we look at the resource base and the input from all of the people that you're talking to, you're going to come to a similar conclusion that, you know, this is probably a fairly balanced, although the industry still has concerns that the rates may be high, but it probably provides balance.
Well, maybe that's a question for the consultants when they come in.
Questions? Senator Terrio.
Thank you. One of the things that I told the CEOs when they were in town is that the people that we've hired to advise us, we've tried to put together a team that have from time to time worked for the company, so we get a little bit of insight on the way the companies think, you know, the way they negotiate, so we can try and figure out the sort of the dynamic of the negotiation. One of the things they indicated to expect is, you know, by and large, when they have worked for companies, when it comes time to strike the deal, or you're getting close to the deal, and people are in a deal-making mood, put everything on the table and see what you can add to the deal. And what are you at liberty to tell us that you've asked to have added to the deal? I understand. I mean, the gas contract itself is one set that we expect to see sometime soon, but you guys have all kinds of things going on with the state at all times. What's been thrown on the table? What can you tell us has been thrown on the table?
I'm afraid you're disappointed. There's maybe we're just not that good of negotiators. I don't know, but nothing was added to the table. I mean, we completed the gas major provision of the gas contract on Saturday. The governor told us what he was going to do on Monday. And we had a discussion with the governor. We told him that we were concerned with what he proposed. And he said, this is what I'm going to do. And through a lot of discussion and debate, we came along with what he was proposing. As Richard said, we think it will give us the balance we need, the predictability and durability we need when we write it into the fiscal contract to allow the gas to go. And when you think about it, that's got to be, the major thing that we're working on is getting the gas to go. And in the end, we got comfortable with it.
Senator Terrio.
I know I'm jumping all over the place here, but one of the things that is involved, well, first of all, the level of investment in the state of Alaska, can you give me an idea how many of those dollars are spent in Alaska versus out-of-state procuring equipment, whatnot? Do you have any idea?
Senator Terrio, through the chair, I think that most of our investments in Alaska are actually operated by others, and most of those procurement activities are conducted by others. So, in fact, most of our dollars flow through joint venture accounts to operators in Alaska. Yeah.
And the other thing that I'm trying to understand is the economy that will come into being for the buying and selling of the credits. And it strikes me that for the smaller independents that don't have production to take the offset from their credit, they're going to be going to a market. And I asked one of our advisors, well, certainly a company that's going to buy the credit, why do they buy a dollar for a dollar? There's what's in it for them. So it'll be bought at somewhat of a discount. And so there's some leakage of the investment money that would have accrued to the state treasury. And so I suggested, well, do we want to consider putting some statutory level in there that you can only apply a credit that was purchased, with a certain percentage of the value being saved for the small independent? And he said, no, just let the market do what it does, and it'll set the rate where it should be. I'm wondering, though, that really the dollar comes from the state treasury, and should we really go with a market system like that, or should we just have a refund so that really is no loss to the state treasury, no leakage out of the system? Did you follow my rambling question?
Well, not exactly, Senator Terry, because I'm not sure that the dollar comes from the state treasury. I guess any leakage, I think, is lost from the explorer, the new entrant, who wasn't able to capture the full value of their credit.
Well, they weren't able to get, got 90 cents on the dollar. The company that bought it gets the full dollar. But the dollar gets expensed back to what would have accrued as PPT tax. So it in effect comes out of the treasury. Instead of going through that multi-step process, the explorer could make their investment. They don't have PPT tax to offset. And so they would just come to the state for a rebate directly from the treasury.
Senator Terrio, you probably could do that. I think that's probably a question for the administration, a policy question, legislative question.
Okay. Do you see if we got into a low price scenario where you really are not generating a lot of taxes, would you be likely to stop playing in that credit buying market, or?
Senator, these are kind of hypothetical questions that are difficult for us to answer because we don't know what the market would even look like, or whether we'd be wanting to buy credits and what the price of those credits would be, and what the administrative burden that might go along with them would be. So it's just a difficult question for us to address.
It is hypothetical. I'm just trying to get my mind around an economy that springs into being that I haven't really thought about. Do you currently buy some credits from the existing system?
We have in the past bought credits.
Okay. And Mr. Chairman, I think we should get from the department. I understand that the companies certainly don't want to give company-specific information, but I think the departments probably have enough information on all the buying and selling of credits that they can give us an idea of what the going rate is without disclosing anything about a particular company.
Those credits are generated through 185, Senate Bill 185, the expiration credits in the past has had.
Senator Wagner, that's correct. We have, under that program, purchase credits. I guess if I could just...
This is working.
if I may just make sure I understand, Senator Terrio, through the chair, your question. If an explorer incurs, let's say, $100 worth of expense, and let's say the tax credit is 10% or $10 in that example, okay? If he goes to the state and asks for a refund, the state's going to reimburse $10. If the credit is sold to another purchaser, that purchaser would also take the credit for $10 against the state's treasury. So I don't see where there would be a net drain to the treasurer. The real loss would be to the explorer. He incurred $100. He didn't get the full value, doesn't get it from the state, but he goes against another purchaser. Maybe he gets sold for a discount, I don't know. But I don't see where the direct impact would be to the,
okay,
to the state.
I think that's probably a good clarification. But if we're trying to incent the explorer, he was only able to get 90 cents on the dollar by selling the credit. If he comes directly to the state for a refund, he can get 100% of the dollar. And so I'm just trying to figure out how that impacts, it affects that economy that we're trying to direct incentive dollars out to the exploration, or the upstarts, and how that system coming into being impacts that. So,
further questions? Seeing then, we'll recess at this time until we get the House left over from their hearing. So, go off record. Okay, next part of the presentation today is by British Petroleum. And Ken, are you the group leader?
Yes, I am.
Turn the meeting over to you. Just before we get started, though, on their agenda that's in the packet, we're going to forego the how we got here part of the presentation. I think we're all pretty well had several presentations of how we got here, and probably pretty similar. So we'll go ahead and start with your section titled Current Realities of Alaska North Slope.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name's Ken Conrad. I'm Vice President of Gas for BP Alaska. We're here today to talk about the proposed PPT legislation. You said this committee is very familiar with how we got here and our prepared testimony in that regard. So if there's no questions around that, I will simply turn it over to Angus Walker, our Vice President of Commercial, and allow him to take us through the other parts of the presentation.
Yep.
And I thought I was going to get a break.
Not on the Senate side, you know.
I'm Angus Walker. I'm the Commercial Vice President for BP in Alaska. And I would like to start by thanking you for this opportunity to testify on the very important matter of House Bill 305. And we do, of course, recognize that PPT, the PPT bill and the subsequent gas contract in due course are some of the most important things that will come before you. Before I start, I'd like to introduce my associates. To my right is Ray Hall, who is a senior tax economist with BP Group in London. Ray is an economist by background and has worked with BP since 1988, initially in commercial roles, but latterly as a senior advisor on fiscal issues. Ray has held positions in organizations outside of BP, including the United Kingdom Offshore Operators Association, UKOR, and the International Association of Oil and Gas Producers. His most recent focus has been UK, Norway, Egypt, and Trinidad. And a man who probably needs no introduction to you, Tom Williams, tax counsel for BP Alaska, and obviously particularly appropriate that Tom is here as he was is widely accredited as the creator of ELF. Our testimony will be in three parts, all of which are directly relevant to PPT. I will start by providing an overview of our business on the North Slope and some of the current realities that we are facing. Ray will then provide a global perspective, comparing fiscal regimes in a selection of countries in which we do business. And then I will conclude by describing the impact of this PPT legislation on BP's business here in Alaska. And I should note that as BP only has leases on the North Slope, that our comments relate to the Alaska North Slope, and we don't participate in any of the other basins, so we can't, our comments are not directed at those. The first slide, which I'm sure is familiar to you, is a view of production from the Alaska North Slope since 1977 through 2005. The North Slope has produced over 15 billion barrels of oil to date, and while we look back with envy at the days of peak production, it is clear that today's business is very different than that of 20 years ago. To date, BP's invested $24 billion in creating the business we have today. We've paid $32 billion in tax to the state of Alaska and $24 billion in tax to the federal government. But the harsh reality is that since production peaked in 1988, production has declined on an average of 6% per year. And what this doesn't show is the very significant efforts that are ongoing each and every day to stem decline. Without investment, the fields on the North Slope would naturally decline at 15% per year or greater. And the industry is investing between $1 and $1.5 billion a year to stem that decline and achieve the 6% decline that's shown by this graph. The second point I'd like to make is that the ELF has worked as intended, and many of the small wedges, small in this graph but very large in reality, come from satellite fields or fields that would have otherwise been a challenge to develop. And although many of those barrels are not paying production tax, they're obviously paying royalty, property tax, and corporate and state corporate income tax. And we would advocate one of the most important issues facing this committee and the legislature is the impact of decline on the future of the Alaska North Slope. And I'll move to my second slide. This is a slide which you may be familiar with. It was presented by Roger Marks in his presentation last week to you. And it basically shows two of the Department of Revenue's scenarios for oil development on the North Slope. And the lower blue line shows oil production assuming that there is no gas pipeline built, and the upper pink or red line shows a forecast of oil production assuming that a gas pipeline is built and that it stimulates further exploration and development. Now, we do agree with the Department of Revenue that the future without gas looks very different than the future with gas. A future without gas is definitely shorter and less exciting than a future with gas to extend the oil business. But it's clear also to us that the foundations of the gas business will be on top of the oil business. And to have a healthy gas business, we need to maintain a healthy oil business for the next 45 years. Both parts of the business must be healthy. So what will it take to keep this business healthy? The next slide is again on decline. And the simple answer, to keep the business healthy, we have to stem that decline. I'll orient you on the slide. Production on the left-hand axis, time along the bottom, and that historical decline shown in black. Now, as we project into the future, in a hypothetical case, if we were to stop investing on the North Slope today, then the fields that are developed to date would decline at 15% or greater without investment. And you'll see that the business would be gone in a relatively short period of time, 10 years or even less. Of course, we are investing, and we're investing as an industry between $1 and $1.5 billion per year in the existing fields. And that, if the historical decline of 6% per year was extended out into the future, then you could see the oil business extending till 2025. And that's just history repeating itself with the same level of investment going out into the future. Of course, we all know that Alaska's got huge resources, and we would like to see the oil business go on for a very much longer period of time. In fact, we need to make the oil business go on for a very long time to support gas. So what would that take? If we could stem decline to 3%.
Got a question, Senator Dyson.
Yeah, forgive me for being late, but we're talking about the investment dollars here. Is that just for BP or slope-wide?
Through the chair, Senator Dyson, that's for the industry slope-wide.
Yeah, thank you.
And if we could stem decline to 3%, which would keep the business running until 2050, something much more in line with the gas pipeline, then that would take $2 to $3 billion a year. So that's a doubling of the investment that the North Slope is currently attracting in order to give the North Slope that kind of 50-year future. And that's a challenge that we face together. We recognize it's our challenge, it's your challenge. And we believe that it's our part of the deal is to bring the technology, the innovation, and the investment to the state of Alaska to make it happen. And we look to the state to maintain a stable and attractive environment such that investments can be made. And I should also draw your attention to the total production in the top right-hand corner there in each scenario, and that's in billions of barrels. If we just let the fields decline, we'd produce 1.3 billion barrels. If we can stem decline to 3% per year, it could be 7.5 billion barrels.
Question. At what point, barrels per day, does the pipeline cease to be economically viable to operate? Does anybody?
Yeah, I think at this point in time, it's fair to say that nobody knows. But there will have to be significant investments made as certain flow rates get reached, because eventually the flow rate will be so low and the temperature of the crude will be so low that other innovative solutions will have to be found. What's the ultimate threshold will depend on ultimately on the investment. I'll move on to my next slide. And so the question is, where will all this oil come from? The point I ought to really have made on the back end of the last slide is clearly the fiscal regime has a very important part to play in attracting the kinds of investment dollars that the North Slope needs. And where will they all come from? Well, the good news for Alaska is that you have a lot of oil and gas. And this is just a brief summary. To date, 15 billion barrels has been produced from the ANS. But there's a staggering 17.5 billion barrels of known resource. That's oil and gas that's already been discovered. We know where it is. We just have the challenge of developing it and getting it to market.
Does that exclude Anwar?
That doesn't exclude Anwar. Mr. Chairman, there's nothing in here that relates to any development or exploration of Anwar.
Okay, thank you.
Of the 17.5 billion barrels of known resource, 3.8 billion barrels have been developed to date. The capital's already been spent. But there's about another 14 billion barrels that's yet to be developed. And that can be found in the existing reservoirs, the light oil reservoirs that we know and have been working for so long, the viscous reservoirs, which we've started to develop but are only on the leading edge of viscous developments. And then there's the huge challenge of the heavy oil sitting in the shallower formations below the permafrost, which today we don't have the technology in Alaska to develop, but we are working very hard to find the right technology for the North Slope. And then, of course, there's gas. And of those 14 billion barrels of undeveloped resource, if one conservatively assumed $6 a barrel to develop them, then that would be $100 billion of investment that would be required. And we would advocate to you that that's an investment which is going to come from the major oil companies of the world. And it's not to say that the independents and the small companies don't have a very important role to play in Alaska, but these huge investments, which involve technical challenges, innovation, leading-edge technology, tens of billions of dollars, are going to come from the major investors in the oil sector. And it is thus a slight mystery to us why so much of the information that's been presented to this committee has been focused on the impact on the new entrants. And we would request that the impact on the major investors should be an important part of your consideration also. Oh, I'm sorry, can I? It's getting late. My apologies. I forgot to make one crucial point, and that is the yet-to-find exploration. And Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely right. These numbers don't include ANWR, and this is a USGS, United States Geological Society, estimate of reserves that are yet to find on the Alaska North Slope. They estimate 5 billion barrels, and it will be found in increasingly small fields, 150, 50 million, etc., and that in all likelihood the large fields have already been discovered. So therefore, in looking forward to trying to stem the decline of the North Slope, clearly exploration is important. It should be encouraged, but the real, we can't rely on it, and the real opportunity is to exploit the resource that we know exists on the North Slope today. It's three times as big as the estimate of what's left to be found. And then we'll just share with you our vision. This is a picture we use internally in BP, have done for the last two or three years, and it captures our vision. When we use it, we there's a few important things that we say to people. The first is that the future is very different than the past. The future is about three businesses, light oil, viscous, and gas, all built on top of each other, and all which must be healthy in order that the other can succeed. That we're only halfway through, actually. We've got a long and glorious future, past going back to 1977, but actually, if we can overcome the challenge of decline on the North Slope, if we can develop the viscous resource, if we can get gas to market, then there's a longer future ahead than the past that we've already had. But we face enormous challenges to create this future, and clearly a good fiscal regime is one of the key enablers to enable us to help deliver this future. I will now hand over to Ray Hall, who's going to provide a global perspective, after which I'll come back and describe the impacts of PPT on BP's business in Alaska.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Ray Hall from BP. I'm based in the UK, and I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to provide testimony to this committee on this very important subject. As Angus said, I'm going to address the issue of trying to put Alaska in some kind of a global context and provide some comparisons with similar tax regimes around the world. This is a very complex area, and we could spend a great deal of time doing this, but what I'm going to try and do is to be selective and talk about regimes which I think are relevant in terms of a comparison to Alaska. Next slide. Oops.
Sorry, Mr. Chairman, we can maybe take a 30-second technical break.
We need to load the presentation. sorry. Maybe I can just talk while my colleague is bringing up the presentation. Hopefully you have paper copies in front of you. What I want to cover in the presentation is to run through a quick outline of the kind of fiscal principles that investors look for when evaluating fiscal regimes around the world to determine whether or not it's appropriate for inward investment. Thank you, Angus. Also, then we'll move on to talk a bit more detail about some countries I've chosen for comparison purposes. If you recall, the expert engaged by the administration, Dr. Muirs, spoke at some length and about the UK and Norway, and I also are going to talk about the UK and Norway, but perhaps add a bit more colour as to the context. I think it is important when we compare fiscal regimes to understand the context in which that fiscal regime has been designed. Critical factors here are the base in issues like the base in maturity, the base in cost structure. Is it low cost? Is it high cost? The nature of the opportunities themselves, are they small volumes, high volumes? Is it low risk? Is it high risk? Where does that basin sit in terms of its proximity to markets, both for oil and gas? So these are some of the important issues that need to be addressed. But in general, well, one can make the point that a higher tax burden will normally result in less investment. Conversely, a lower tax burden will normally encourage and result in higher investment. If we look at some of the principles that govern fiscal regime design, I've listed a number of them here. Firstly, the regime should be equitable or fair. It gives an appropriate and consistent return to the investor consistent with the risks he is undertaking. The regime should be simple as far as possible. I should say that most regimes don't score very well on this particular attribute. And if we look at Alaska with its complex cocktail of taxes, I think Alaska probably wouldn't score very well. But however, it should be added that the changes proposed to ELF towards the replacement PPT is a step in the right direction. I think we could all agree that the proposed PPT is a lot simpler to understand than the ELF tax it will replace. Another important characteristic is stability. Investors look for stability in a fiscal regime such that the economics of investment commitments they have made are not undermined by future tax changes. Also, ideally, a fiscal regime should be structured such that the taxes are levied on profits and not levied on revenues. And I guess the relevant point here is royalty. Royalty is a tax on revenue, not a tax on profits. And I will explain with some examples later. We do notice a number of trends in maturing basins that the royalty burden is alleviated or indeed removed altogether as basins mature. Another important feature, and perhaps the most important feature, as I've already mentioned, is that the regime needs to be competitive, i.e. that the structure of the regime reflects the opportunities, the nature of the opportunities that are present in the regime. I should say there is no unique answer here. There is no simple answer. There are literally hundreds of different fiscal regimes all around the world. They all vary. And you can't point to one regime and say, great, that is the best regime, we should apply it everywhere. Context is critical. Just to help you with some additional information as to why I've chosen the regimes we have, this chart illustrates the leading global oil and gas producers in 2004. And hopefully you can see from that chart that the countries we're using to compare against are very important producing provinces. The USA is the second largest producer of oil and gas in the world, and I've broken out in the pie there where that key production comes from. You can see Alaska is about 1 million barrels a day. The Gulf of Mexico is about 1.5 million barrels a day from oil and gas together. But the vast bulk still comes from the lower 48, very large production numbers indeed. Norway is the sixth largest global producer of oil and gas in the world, and the UK comes in at number 9. So these are both very, very important basins for the international oil industry to consider when it's determining where it's going to allocate its investment. Now, this chart attempts to summarize very briefly the marginal tax rate that applies in these key comparator basins. And just to remind you, the marginal tax rate, Mr. Chairman, is simply illustrating if you have an additional $100 of revenues, where is that $100 going to? This illustrates the share of that additional revenue that is taken by the government. So here we have the Gulf of Mexico at 45%, one of the, well, in fact, the lowest out of these selected countries. The UK is next with 50%. I should point out that up until the 1st of January this year, the UK was only 40%, so it would have been the lowest before the recently announced tax change in the UK. The proposed changes in Alaska will take it from 56% today to 61%. And lastly, we have Norway at extreme right at 78%. But there are some other important factors.
Senator French, you had a question.
I do. I want to make sure I understand this slide, Mr. Hall. The way you explain it is, if all things being equal, if we take in an extra $100 of revenue, you take in $100 of revenue, the state would get 56 of those dollars under the current ELF formula?
Yes.
Total government will take. That's
including the
state.
Including the feds.
But that the PPT bill before us, everything else being equal, would produce 5% more.
That's
total
correct.
Government take.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that's roughly how much of that is Fed? Because the Fed's being held. I mean, the Fed isn't changing, right?
Goes down.
No, the Feds right. will go down.
So how much of that is state take, I guess, is my question.
Through the chair, Senator French, we're actually coming back to explicitly talk about the share of the state, the federal government, and the industry.
So there's more slides in the future.
There is, yeah. Yeah, if it's possible to hold the question, I think we'll address
Fair
it
enough.
Then.
Fair enough.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Stevens?
Clarify. So this marginal rate is for the BP financials, or is it for the industry?
Mr. Chairman, this will be for the industry, looking at the industry as a whole.
Senator Terrio.
If I'm remembering, when ConocoPhillips presented, I believe, they had the, under PPT, the total governmental take, I think, didn't they suggest that it went up to 67%? And I was flipping through Pedro's presentation yesterday. I thought that on some of the graphs that it showed under PPT that we get up just under 60%. So I'm wondering, as you've been scurrying to put together your presentation, have you conferred with the other companies? Is there actually a difference of opinion on what the total governmental take gets to? Because it's my remembrance from what's been presented here that there seems to be some difference.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, perhaps I could address that. I think we have to be very careful in this area, because there's obviously any number of different numbers. What we're looking at in this graph is the marginal take, which is the take on the extreme. So if you took a company and added and they'd had it, made an extra $100, how much of that would go to the government? And I can't say I'm familiar with the reference you make to Conoco's presentation, but it could be that that's an effective government take at a certain price in a certain scenario. And later in our presentation, we'll show you what the effective government take is through all the price range on BP. So there are a lot of numbers here, and we have to all be careful that we keep them all in context. But we can certainly check up on what Conoco's reference was.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, if I continue. A couple of other points to make here is that the headline, or those marginal tax rates, only tell part of the story. One also needs to consider the treatment of capital cost reliefs that are applicable. For example, in the UK, following a tax reform in 2002, you get 100% relief for capital investment you make. What that means is that if you invest in a new project in the UK, that project will pay no tax whatsoever until that project has secured payback on the investment. That is quite unique when you're looking at regimes around the world. And also in Norway has uplift available on capital investment. And when you combine that with a very high average tax rate of 78%, the net result is if you invest $1 in Norway, you get 93 cents of relief for that investment. So you get a very high level of tax relief because you have the combination of the uplift in combination with a very high tax rate. I mentioned earlier that one of the principles, Mr. Chairman, that companies look for is for taxes to be based on profits rather than revenues. Here is an example of a trend we've seen certainly in the UK and Norway. When the UK first started out back in the 60s, there was an across-the-board royalty of 12.5%. That has now been abolished completely, so there's no royalty at all in the UK. If we go to Norway originally had a royalty rate ranging from 8 to 16%. That has also been progressively abolished. There is no royalty in Norway. So for both the UK and Norway, all the taxes are levied on profits. There are no taxes on revenues. And even near as a home in the Gulf of Mexico, we do have royalty relief available for some of the deep water licenses. So there is a suspension of royalty in deep water on the up to the first 88 million barrels of production. And I will show a further example later in this presentation as to another example of royalty relief being applied in the heavy oil province in Alberta. Just moving now to some facts and figures around the UK. The top right chart there illustrates the historic production in the UK, and the chart underneath it shows the production relative to the domestic consumption. And I think that's a very important consideration that has driven policy in the UK. The UK government has been very keen to ensure that the country is self-sufficient in its energy needs for as long as possible. So the initial development of the basin proceeded very rapidly in the 1970s, and in fact within a very fairly short period of time from oil production starting, self-sufficiency was secured by about 1980. That position has endured up until the current day, but it is forecast that the UK will need to start importing growing quantities of oil and gas within the next few years. Government policy has been very much focused on maximizing activity in the basin, maximizing developments, maximizing exploration, and indeed for the latter part of the 1990s, the UK attracted more exploration and appraisal dollars than any other basin in the world, and I'll explain in a minute why that happened. Also, the UK has been very successful in encouraging a large number of participants. There are 142 licensees in the UK currently, which is a very high number by global standards. Now, one of the reasons for this, if we zoom in a bit, which on this next slide, what I've plotted here is the marginal tax rate, that sort of blue line with diamonds on it over time, and the corresponding line in red of production in the basin. The important relationship we see there was that in 1993 there was a very substantial tax reform which reduced the marginal rate of tax on new developments from in excess of 80% down to 30%. That 30% rate endured for nearly 10 years. As I was saying earlier, that led to a huge increase in activity in the basin. We saw rising investment, and as a result of that, rising production. And the interesting aspect of this is that although we saw tax rates being reduced, tax yield actually went up. And what this chart illustrates is that...
Excuse me, can we back up this other chart? When the tax cut took place in 1993, even before 93, you showed an increase beginning in your production rate. And the tax rate took place between 93 and 94. So should there be a lag in there on production? I mean, how does production jump up and start increasing as fast as it does?
Well, you're right.
Because, you know, on the slope and in the Cook Inlet, where I'm familiar with, you have a lag time from the time you start your development and production. There's a lag time there of 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, yes, there clearly is a lag between investment and production. But I think what you can see from the line is the rate at which it was subsequently increased was much greater following the tax change in 1993. And as I recall, we've been there at the time, a lot of the discussion with the government came through companies, operators saying, if you go through with this tax change, then we will bring forward a number of specific investments. And I know from BP, we were very closely involved in this discussion. And we did indeed bring forward a significant number of developments as a result of this tax increase, which would not have happened had it not occurred. But I think the important linkage also with this change is that if we look at the tax yield that resulted from this change, what this chart illustrates is the...
Senator Elt had another question.
Sorry.
Is that on that same chart?
It's the same chart, different point on the chart. Mr. Hall, I'm curious, when you go out to 2002 where you show the 2002 tax increase,
yeah,
and it says sweetened with 100% capital allowances. I'm curious, and roughly it looks like the marginal tax rate went from 30 to 40 in 2002. I'm curious, when the UK did that, did they do a clawback provision on the 100% capital allowances? When they changed their tax regime, did they look backward for the investment credits?
I think you're asking whether there were transitional arrangements.
We've been calling them clawbacks.
Okay, whatever.
Testifiers have been calling them.
I think the important change in 2002, which accompanied that increase in the overall marginal tax rate, was that the government, as I said, changed the way in which depreciation worked for tax purposes. Prior to the change in 2002, if you made an investment, you were only able to relieve it at 25% per annum on a writing down basis. So it took you a significant number of years for that investment to secure relief against tax. What the government did was, as I said, they changed the provisions relating to depreciation, which gave you the ability to offset your investment fully in the year in which you incur it. That change, as I said, was they took the view that change was sufficiently fundamental and sufficiently beneficial that there was no need for a transitional arrangement.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
As I say, if you make an investment in a new project in the UK, you pay no tax on that project until you have secure payback, which is, as I say, very unusual. If you look around the world,
Well, it's very similar to what we've done just lately with the royalty reduction, same thing. So we're familiar with that. Senator Seacon?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have to go to a, present a matter at Legislative Council, but before I do, for the sake of full disclosure, I'd like to say that on the record, that my daughter's husband is employed by BP, satisfactorily employed, but just for the record.
Thank you. I'll continue, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
Go ahead. Yes.
I think it was important to look at this chart in combination with this particular chart on tax revenue, because what resulted, hopefully you can see this from the chart, if we take the year 2001, the overall tax yield from the basin in 2001 was five times the yield in 1991, 10 years earlier. The oil prices in real terms were broadly the same. So what we had here was a very large reduction in tax rates, which resulted in a huge increase in activity in investment in exploration and investment in new developments, which increased production, which generated more tax. So what happened is here that the government reduced its share of the pie, but produced such a large or much increased pie, that it more than compensated for the reduction in the headline rate. So it just sort of demonstrates that if we can focus on making the pie as big as possible, that's a much more productive conversation than getting into a discussion around who gets what slice. If we go on to talk about Norway now, and I know that the administration's consultant, Dr. Mears, made a lot of comparisons between Norway and Alaska. I would contend, actually, that there are far more differences between Alaska and Norway than there are similarities. Let me explain. If we look at the bottom right-hand bar chart, that illustrates the largest fields in the North Sea, taking UK and Norway together. And we can see that nature's been very, very generous to the Norwegians. They do have some wonderful fields that have been discovered, some very, very large fields. If we take the largest one there, the Troll field, that is 10 billion barrels of oil equivalent. And if we go down the list, there are still some very large fields. Ekofisk, nearly 7 billion. Statfjord, over 4 billion. These are world-class fields. They're large. They have fantastic reservoir properties. The recovery factor on Statfjord is something like 70%, which is a fantastic recovery factor by global standards. In contrast, the UK only has four fields out of the top 14. Norway is also in the position that actually production in overall terms is still growing. Oil production has peaked, but gas production is growing very rapidly. And production in the Norwegian basin will probably continue to increase for 3 or 4 years before it starts to flatten out. But perhaps the most important thing about Norway, and this is where one of the big differences comes in, is the role of the state. If you look at the bottom pie chart, the Norwegian state directly owns a third of the resource in terms of remaining reserves in production. It also has two very important companies in which it owns a significant stake. Statoil, indicated there in red, is owned 70% by the Norwegian government, and until the end of 2000 was owned 100% by the Norwegian government. Norsk Hydro is currently owned about 40% by the Norwegian government. So what you have here is the state directly owning a very large proportion of the resource, and it is able, through its either directly or indirectly through these agents, to influence the pace at which the basin is developed. And because you have so much of the resource being owned, or the production being owned by the state, it's able to sustain a high tax rate, because essentially the tax is going from one pocket of the state to the other pocket of the state. And this is a very important distinction, and I think it explains a lot why Norway has been able to sustain the high tax rate it does have for so long. Today, the Norwegian government is very keen to encourage more participants into the basin, and they have taken some measures to try and encourage that. They recently introduced an incentive for exploration, that if you're a new entrant, a newcomer, and you're not currently paying tax, and you spend $100 on exploration, they will send you a check in the post at the end of the year for $78. So they will essentially put you in the position as if you were paying tax, even though you're not. They're also trying to give more acreage to new entrants to encourage them. But I think if you talk to most independent companies in the industry, they would still tell you that the 78% tax rate is a major continuing barrier to attract new entrants into the basin, when just next door into the UK, you will pay a much, much lower tax rate. I think it's also instructive to come nearer home and look at the Gulf of Mexico. Again, here we have a basin that's seen some tremendous success in recent years. In the period between 1993 and 2004, it had the highest exploration and appraisal spend of any basin in the world. It had the second highest volume of discovered reserves of any basin in the world. We have seen, if you look at the bottom left-hand graph, a very rapid growth in production. Today, it's already at 1.5 million barrels a day. That will keep increasing, such by 2008, in excess of 2.5 million barrels a day. You know, one of the key factors that it has encouraged this has been the low tax rate that applies in the Gulf of Mexico. As you saw from the chart earlier, it's 45%. If you get the deep water royalty relief, it's 35% whilst that prevails. This is not an easy environment, though, it should be said. We're looking at tremendous challenges in technology. We're developing fields in excess of 2,000 meters water depth, which is very much leading edge. And also, as we've seen in the recent year, that basin, that environment has to contend with some very adverse weather conditions, which can disrupt production. But I think overall, this is an example of a low tax rate encouraging and promoting very high activity levels.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Elton.
Mr. Hall, I mean, the second blue line on this slide says that in the Gulf, the second highest discovered volumes. I mean, we've heard testimony previous to your testimony that one of the things about the Alaska oil regime is nobody expects to find any more big fields, that it's going to be small incremental additions to production. And it would seem to me that would, I mean, that when you make an investment decision, it may be easier to make an investment decision in the Gulf, not because of the tax rate, but because of the possibility of finding larger quantities of oil. Is that an assumption that is correct on my part?
I mean, Mr. Chairman, perhaps I could address the question because I think it's related to Alaska. I think what we have to consider is the resource base that we have here in Alaska. It is a huge resource base, but it's a challenged resource base. And it's that challenging resource, the nature of the resource base, combined with the fiscal terms that are, so we say, not attracting the billions of dollars that are required in Alaska.
Mr. Chair, if I could follow up. I hope I'm not misstating what I thought I heard before, but what I've heard before is that when you talk about the Alaska resource base, that we pretty much know that there's probably not any huge bodies of oil or gas out there that we don't know about. But when I look at this and I see that in the Gulf, the second highest discovered volumes, I mean, I'm assuming, maybe I'm assuming incorrectly, I'm assuming that a major producer like yourself who wants to make an investment decision is probably going to weigh the possibility of finding a mega field versus the possibility of finding a smaller incremental field in Alaska.
I think you're absolutely right. There's a fundamental difference between the resource base in the Gulf of Mexico. There's still presumably a good chance of finding some large fields through exploration. And I think most people would agree in Alaska that the fields to be found through exploration are going to be small and possibly marginal. But where the activity is required is on the it's the same principle. We need to stimulate activity on the 14 billion barrels of oil that we know. So it's a different resource base, but we would advocate the principle is the same. We still need investment dollars, but they need to be spent on developing the oil and gas that's discovered already, rather than exploring for new oil and gas, which is clearly more appropriate in the Gulf of Mexico.
Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I'll continue. I think one of the interesting comparisons we can also make is we don't need to go around the world to find examples of where a tax reform has encouraged increased investment. Just across the border here into Canada and Alberta, we've seen, if anything, an investment boom taking place in the heavy oil industry, which this graph attempts to summarize. On the topmost graph, you will see the investment that is currently going into the heavy oil province in Alberta. That has rapidly increased from very small amounts in the mid-1990s up to something like $7 billion in last year, with the predictions of $10 billion annually within a couple of years. Now, if you compare $10 billion of investment annually with Alaska, where Alaska is running it between $1 and $1.5 billion, so almost an order of magnitude greater investment going into the heavy oil province in Alberta. Obviously, that will translate itself into a production response, and you'll see underneath there we will also expect to see a very rapid increase in production in the Alberta heavy oil province. And indeed, within a few years, that is expected to exceed 2 million barrels a day and go on to in excess of 3 million barrels a day within the next 10 years. So a very rapid increase in activity, a very rapid increase in production. I think one of the interesting things from a fiscal perspective is to look at what Canadian government did to encourage that investment. They introduced a major fiscal reform in 1995. In essence, what the regime is today is that on royalty, the royalty rate is simply 1% until your project has achieved payback. And that payback includes an allowance for a nominal return based on the risk-free Canadian bond rate. So until you have earned to this minimum return on your investment, the royalty rate is 1%. In addition to that, you will pay federal and state taxes, which take the marginal rate to 39%. Post-payback, the rate will increase because of the higher royalty, but that will only be 54%. And also, we need to reflect on the fact that there is already in existence a phased reduction in federal tax rates, which will reduce those marginal rates further, such that by 2007, the marginal tax rate pre-payout will be around about 35%, and the top tax rate post-payout will be of the order of 50%. So this reform has had a major impact in stimulating a huge amount of investment, a huge amount of activity in this heavy oil province. Looking at the next slide, we can make further comparisons here in the US and North America. This slide gives you a kind of a very quick summary of marginal tax rates in a number of US states. And you can see the progression there. We have also included Canada to carry on from the previous slide. So we have the Alberta heavy oil regime with 39% prepay out. Gulf of Mexico at 45%. Most of the other lower 48 states around the low 50s in terms of tax. Alaska, with the proposed changes, will be 61%, so it'll have the highest marginal tax rate in North America.
Chairman. Senator French.
Thank you. I'm sure some folks at home right now are asking themselves this question, so I'm just going to ask it for their entertainment if they're suffering through this hearing or participating happily through this hearing. If we're about to raise our tax rate to the highest in North America, you know, your point is we're going to crush investment in the state because the lower tax rates of Alberta and the Gulf of Mexico are the ones that really are getting the investments necessary to stimulate production. And yet, you know, I take it you guys are more or less comfortable with PPT or else you wouldn't be here. And right behind PPT is, at least in many of our minds, an enormous amount of investment in a gas project. So I guess, I mean, how do you reconcile the idea that we're now going to have one of the highest rates in the nation for government take and a big investment in a projected gas line?
Mr. Chairman, Senator French, that's what concerns us. Because clearly, in order to have a gas project, we need a healthy oil business that's going to be here for 50 years. And our concern is that in order to create that business, Alaska needs to attract twice as much capital as it's attracting today to stem decline and extend the North Slope out another 50 years, and that we actually don't believe that that's consistent with increasing your tax rate so dramatically. So therefore, we are, just to be clear on BP's position on PPT bill, we are, and have been since the governor introduced it, we recognize that the PPT structure has merit. We think it is a structure which could serve Alaska well over the long term, but we believe the 20% tax rate is too high. And that's one of the key points in our testimony today.
Senator Elton.
Thanks. And for whoever wants to address the question, and I may be making some assumptions here, but on this chart, if you take a look at Texas, Oklahoma, and California, and the government take there is pretty consistent. It is consistent at 53%. How much of the government take in those three states is attributed to royalty oil?
I'd have to get back to you on that. I mean, I don't have the figures with me.
I'd be interested because it would seem to me that a large component of the 61% of Alaska PPT is royalty oil, and so if you could get back to me on what it is. And if you're going to do Texas, Oklahoma, and California, maybe Colorado, Wyoming, too, because okay. They're pretty close.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, I'll now move to the final slide, just to summarize the presentation. I think what we were trying to present to you is that when we're comparing different fiscal regimes, the context is key. We need to look beyond the headline marginal rates and recognize the key characteristics of the basin, its maturity, the nature of the opportunities, how close the basin is to markets, and its overall cost structure. I think also, hopefully, with the limited examples I've shown you, there is clear evidence of a relationship between fiscal policy and subsequent basin activity. And we've hopefully been able to show through the examples of the UK, Gulf of Mexico, and Alberta that a lower tax burden will stimulate investment, and a higher tax burden runs the risk of reducing investment. And I think, as a concluding remark, as we saw from the previous slide, you are potentially moving to a position where you will have the highest marginal tax rate here in North America. And that, in combination with probably the highest cost structure in North America, may not be conducive to encouraging the investment that this basin needs for its future. Thank you.
Senator Elton.
Mr. Hall, you carefully used the word may not be inducive, and so when you say may, I mean, it seemed to me the whole theme of your presentation is that lower taxes increase investment, which increases production. And it seems to me the corollary is higher taxes decreases investment, decreases government take. But you said may. I mean, maybe you can expand on why you don't think that might be the case in this instance.
I think there's actually a much harder link. I have a feeling Ray was being slightly polite. I think there's a very hard link between fiscal take and the investment which will be attracted to Alaska. And it is diametrically opposed to think that on the one hand, we need twice as much investment on the North Slope as we have today, on the other hand, you're going to raise taxes to the highest level in North America. So I think there's a hard, I think there's a harder link than the word may provides. And could I ask Mr. Conrad to make a comment?
Yeah, I think, or through the chair, Senator Elton, some of that was the context that we understood that this committee already understood, and we skipped initially. And I think Angus touched on it earlier. There are many positive attributes to this PPT. There's a lot of good things about it, and we've been a very clear supporter of the structure. And we think there's good things that can happen for investors. There's good things that can happen for Alaska. We were part of the context was that our chief executives were put in a difficult position of well, what will it take to actually begin to try to create this 50-year future? We'll, and we said we would accept the 2020 as part of a bigger package. It wasn't an easy decision. It was not an easy decision. That does not mean, and we will, and we'll stand behind that, absolutely stand behind that. That does not mean that that will maximize recovery from the basin. We are prepared to go ahead on that basis, but Alaska, as a matter of policy, needs to decide where do I want my risk profile in terms of attracting capital to the basin, and that's what we're trying to illuminate today.
Senator Stevens.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Hall, for your presentation and the comparison of different tax regimes. I'm not sort of been a skeptic of comparison to separate regimes. I wondered if we go back to your slide number five and number six. And the reason why I want to go back there is because you mentioned significant capital cost recovery programs in the UK and uplift agreements that are compared to in Norway. And I guess the question I have is, and I could also compare to slide number 13 that we have. Well, on slide six, the marginal tax rate that applies on profit. That's correct?
Yes. Well, it's just if you get an additional $100 of revenue.
The revenue.
Well, where is that going?
Yeah. But if you say that in the UK you have 100% cost recovery, then that puts it in a whole nother realm because you've already absorbed all your capital costs. And so to compare that to Alaska, where the revenue is taxed as it comes in, and even under the new credit mechanism, it's depreciated in the same year. It's a different scenario where in the UK you have no taxation until full recovery. In Alaska you have taxation, but only after a portion of your deposit. I mean your investment is recovered, and then again in Norway, you have the 93% uplift agreement. If I heard what you
yes,
said.
Yes.
So again, you can't compare the marginal rates to Alaska because the dynamics are all different. I know you're not trying to. I'm just trying to make the point that even though the marginal rate of increase that we show here, it still doesn't take into consideration when does the cash flow begin to be a tax, or the marginal revenue begin to be taxed. Alaska is taxed immediately. In the UK, it wouldn't be taxed until capital cost is fully recovered. Is that what I thought I heard you say?
Well, there are perhaps many, many different ways of expressing, you know, the relative taxes in these different provinces. I've chosen to do it on a marginal tax rate because it's simpler. Another way of doing it would be to look at the average tax rate or the overall government take over the life of the project. But I think they would broadly give you the same direction or the relative positions. If you analyze this in different ways, I still think the overall ranking we're seeing here will be broadly unchanged, that the most attractive regimes will still be the Gulf of Mexico and the UK. The least attractive regime is probably Norway, but in Alaska is, say, as we were saying earlier, it'll still come out as having the most onerous regime in North America.
Alaska is, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Stevens.
And then your comparison when you brought in the investment that's taking place, and if we recall our presentation from yesterday, one of the other only regions in the world that has a higher cost structure than Alaska was Canada, and yet the information you provide us about the Canadian tax regime. Can't figure out what page that's on.
13.
I think what you're alluding to is within Canada there are a number of different provinces.
I'm mainly speaking to the heavy.
Yes.
Heavy
yeah. Oil. Yeah. The example I showed you was just a heavy oil tax regime. There are different tax regimes in Canada for other provinces. I think your example you were referring to, Senator, was the Canada East Coast. That is indeed a very high cost regime.
Both of them they had in that chart.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. But even for those, the overall tax burden in those provinces is still less than the proposed change in Alaska.
I don't disagree with that. And the point I was trying to make was the cost structure. Comparison of our cost structure to the other regions of the world that have higher cost structure, and it appears that what they've done is they've actually incentivized investment by deferring royalty till after payout, and then deferring the tax rate to pre-payout versus post-payout. And I believe their payouts based on an ROR.
Yes, right.
It's a much more complicated system than ours.
The rate of return based criteria, actually they're not as complicated as you might imagine. We were seeing this quite widely actually in production sharing contracts around the world. A lot of the new ones that are being negotiated are indeed based on a rate of return mechanism. So it is a well tried and well proven mechanism, and we were seeing it being introduced in a number of provinces, and certainly Canada has gone down that road in a major way, and it's proving to be very successful.
Senator Stebbin.
Mr. Chairman. The statement I want to make is that I just find that the information is intriguing in the fact that the areas that have had the most increase in production, at least I think that these are the areas by the chart that you've showed that are in the top producing regions of the globe. The areas that have had the largest increases in production may also have a higher tax rate, but they have a significant mechanism for capital cost recovery, whether it be a CCR or an uplift agreement or a ROR mechanism that's not embedded in this proposal. And those are the areas that have attracted the investment to increase production. we should consider that. If that's, if our objective is to maintain or increase production, I think we need to look at the documents and the evidence where it's occurred in other areas of the globe.
Senator Stedman?
Just, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just as an kind of an add-on on the rate of return regimes around the world that it seem that some countries are shifting to in the last decade or so, or the last few years. Isn't that not a fairly progressive system versus the, you know, regressive nature of the royalty and tax scenario, and our basically a proposed flat system, the way Alaska's current, way this bill currently combines the 2020 with the royalty and property tax?
Well, I'll let Angus talk about Alaska, but if we look at the rate of return regimes around the world, yes, I mean they are responsive. I mean, at low prices, the overall tax burden is much less than it would be at high taxes. Also, if you have a very high cost project or a marginal project, again, the tax burden will be lower because simply the overall tax take is based on the rate of return. So there's a kind of an automatic balancing mechanism in those sorts of regimes.
If we're looking at trying to stimulate Alaska so we can, you know, have a 50-year time horizon in front of us, what kind of stimulus would you like to see?
Yeah,
I'm not saying you'll get it. I'm just saying, Jeff.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I think we've always said that the PPT structure is just one structure. It has many components, and you could change the components, or you could adopt a completely different structure, so long as the balance is right. And it's about the balance of investors being able to understand the rules, being able to invest with confidence, and being able to get a sufficient return that their capital will flow to Alaska versus other parts of the world. So I think we're seeing as many ways that Alaska could structure this regime, but it does need to be one which attracts significant investment.
Can I ask?
Senator Stedman?
It's kind of an elusive answer. Let me ask it another way. When the tax portion, right now it's kind of 2020, so it gets confusing for a lot of people, but the tax at 20% and the credit at 20%, the tax, it swings the cash flow substantially relative to the credit. So if we were trying to encourage more development, what end of that teeter-totter should be moved?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, I wasn't deliberately trying to be evasive. I think the real issue is it's actually very difficult to know exactly what the right, time will only tell what the right balance would be. But in the first instance, we fundamentally believe the tax rate is too high, that the burden of taxation, as we'll show, as the way it affects our business, it is on the high end of the scale. And therefore, we would advocate a lower tax. But we do believe the credit system is very effective in stimulating investment. Our effective tax rate in Alaska would be, in the new regime, would be significantly higher if we chose not to invest versus investing. So the credit system and the PPT structure helps in Alaskan investments, but fundamentally the tax rate at the moment, in our opinion, is too high. So lowering the tax rate would be objective number one.
Okay. I've got some more, but I'll pick them up later. Let someone else have a turn.
Senator Terrio.
Thank you. First, Senator Stephen, I'm sorry, I was reading something when you were making your last sum up. Did you suggest that you just look at the other areas or look at the other systems, really, to see if it's the system that drives the investment or just the overall?
No, what I I think we need to keep into consideration, Mr. Chairman, in answer, what I meant was, I mean, we need to keep in consideration how those regimes approached adding production and why they had may have had a higher tax system as the end result to get to the higher production. They offered greater upfront incentives than what we have ever had, I believe, or what is contained in the bill. That's what I was trying to say.
Thanks. So, I just didn't want to miss that since I was reading something here. Just on the ROR systems, can you tell me, do you participate in those, and what is the rate of return? Is there an average rate of return, or does it vary widely?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, we do participate in a number of these rate of return production sharing contracts. I can name a few countries like Angola, Azerbaijan in particular, where we have these sorts of contracts. I should say that they do vary significantly. There is no sort of universal standard. They're very much matched to individual opportunities. So within each of those countries, you may well see a whole range of different formulas. There'll still be rate of return driven production sharing contracts, but the sort of bands and the trigger points at which the rate of return will trigger a change in government take will vary significantly. And they're very much negotiated on a case-by-case basis to match the opportunity, the nature of the opportunity, the cost structure, the likely size of the field, is it oil, is it gas, and so on. So they are quite flexible, and you can it's quite easy to come up with different structures, and you can run all kinds of models to get the answer that both sides can agree upon.
Mm-hmm. And the one thing saying that, well, it's quite progressive, and of course, high price, low cost, you get your cost back, you get your rate of return, and then everything else, I guess, accrues to the state. And one of the things that I've consistently asked is, problem with the current system is because it wasn't sensitive to price. When we got to today's high prices, it's unfair to the government, unfair to the state, and so the system itself brings the instability, and causes us to be here considering what we do to change the tax. I'm just wondering, in general, your comments on progressivity, so that at very high prices, that you don't have a system that drives that. It in itself is not destabilizing and forcing the government to either find a way around the tax to impose a new layer of tax or rewrite the entire tax.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Terrio, maybe I can make a comment in the first part of this answer. The information we're going to come on to will show to you one of the big problems that Alaska had. It has, because of its cost base and because of the royalty structure, there is very little, if any, profit to be made in Alaska at low prices. Therefore, at higher, medium to high prices, we absolutely have to make a good, stroke reasonable profit in order to make investments in Alaska worthwhile. And therefore, the talk of progressivity in Alaska is, in our mind, very dangerous, because that's the area we've got to keep in mind. That's when we make a profit, and that's why we're here, for the years when the oil price is on the medium to high end rather than the low end. So to offer that as context.
Yeah, so at high prices, though, you might have a situation where the state's take goes down.
And that's exactly what we're just about to come on to, is the total government take in Alaska and how it affects our business between PPT and the status quo with ELF.
So that system, though, is not stable. From the government's point of view, we're not even getting a flat rate. It goes down at high price.
And I think I think what we'll demonstrate is that the PPT shifts a significant amount of the share back from industry to the government, to the state of Alaska, And that's one of the, I presume, the attractive features of the PPT and why it was proposed by the administration. But again, I would repeat, you know, that the investors absolutely need to make a fair profit at medium and high prices, because we absolutely don't make it at low prices.
Thank you.
Mr.
We've got a couple more questions. Senator French?
Just while we're on that topic, early in your presentation this evening, you mentioned that you'd invested your company had invested $24 billion to create the Alaska business you have today, and you'd paid over $32 billion in tax to the state of Alaska and $24 billion of tax to the federal government. I guess the one number that I saw missing there was, you know, how your company has profited during that same time. Do you have a number that you can assign to that value?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Senator French, we were asked exactly the same question in the House, and we said that we'd go back looking. I think it's a public record, our profits, so therefore we would go back and we'd make that available.
Senator Stedman?
Yeah, just to back up for a minute, you know, as we work through this restructuring and, you know, try to come up with something that's going to test or stand the test of time for decades, possibly, there's always a chance that you know, it becomes unfair to one side or the other. And I guess there's just a little bit of caution, I think, on both of our parts, you know, that the table is actually, you know, within reasonable ranges going forward, so we don't have to get in a situation where the industry gets to a point where they retard their growth and or the opposite happens, where we end up getting in a disadvantaged position.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Stedman, I mean, we absolutely share that concern. One of the great things about profit-based structures is that they are taxes on profit. So therefore, inherently, we would hope that if the system is designed and implemented correctly, it should be durable for the long term. But we do share, we obviously share your concern and sympathize with it.
How much longer would you estimate we have?
Mr. Chairman, I have five slides which I can canter through fairly quickly, if you can indulge us. The final part of our presentation tonight is to describe to you the impacts of PPT on BP's business in Alaska. And we will do that through what is hopefully by now the familiar lens of government tape. And just so that we're absolutely clear what we're talking about, we've included this definition of government take as the percentage of total profit that's taken by the host government. And on the top of that equation is total taxes paid, and on the bottom is total taxes plus industry profit. And obviously in Alaska we're paying royalty, production tax, property tax, income tax. And on top of that, we're paying federal income tax. So all of these components are rolled up into the total government take numbers that you'll see tonight.
I'm sorry, I can't resist.
Senator French.
I mean, part of this equation is requiring you to calculate your industry profit, right?
Indeed, that's right.
And yet, it's not a number you have at your fingertips or handy.
Mr. Chairman, Senator French, I think what you asked was this total profit we've made from Alaska in the last 30 years, which is a number I don't have at my fingertips.
But you've got it for all the relevant periods that you're about to give us.
Within here there is... what the data I'm going to show you is built off our forecast for 2006, so it's built on using real data in the 2006 period. We'll just use that as an illustration.
I see.
Obviously, we don't know what our profit's going to be in 2006, but assuming certain oil prices and that we spend a certain amount of capital and operating costs, then that's what flows through.
I see. Thank you.
What we're looking at here is a graph of government take versus oil price, and that's ANS West Coast price. And the dotted line, which is marked status quo, is the government take from BP's business in Alaska in totality over the, assuming the existing system with ELF. And the green line is the government take from BP, assuming the PPT as it's drafted. And the first thing to note is that at low prices, and we'll look at the $20 here, the government take under the current system actually exceeds 100%. And that's very simply because at that point we are making a loss, but we're still paying royalty, production taxes, state income tax, federal tax, property tax. Under the new system, you'll see that at low prices, the shift in government take allows us to make a very modest profit. But at medium to high prices, the government take is increased. The other point to note is around the $30 mark, which not very long ago we would have considered to be a high price for oil, the government take is 70%, which is indeed very high. And that's the actual government take on BP's business here in Alaska. I'm now going to move on to show you.
Senator Elton.
Before you move on, and Mr. Walker, I appreciate this. Two questions. I mean, I'm trying to figure out where the crossover point is for ELF and for PPT. And it looks on this graph as if it's about $30. Am I misreading the graph?
For BP, that's
BP.
Right.
Okay.
For ANS, West Coast.
The price is ANS West Coast, but the graphs are calculated on BP's business, so therefore the crossover, the Senator's absolutely right, the crossover point for BP is at $30 ANS West Coast.
Yeah. And then the second thing, and you don't need to try and convince me now, but I would be very, very interested in any data that you could, I mean, it seems startling to me that you're not making a profit at $20 a barrel, and I just, you just need to convince me. You don't need to convince me now, but in the next few days, it would be helpful if somebody could show me why you're not making money at $20 a barrel.
Yeah, we're very happy to do that. I wish it was different. The other point, while we've gone back to this chart, I'd just like to make is that clearly Alaska is a tough place because of the cost environment and the fiscal regime to make money at low to medium prices. So therefore, it is a price play. So the reason people invest in Alaska is that on certain years when the price is higher, we make more. And those years have to cover the lean years. So the concern we have about the conversation about higher tax rates is that all that's happening here is we're eating into the profit margin for the industry. And if we do that at medium and high prices, there will be no reason to come to Alaska to invest. We need to leave a reasonable profit for the industry at medium and high prices, because we certainly don't get it at low prices. We'll move on to our representation of government take, and the pies represent the total take at any price scenario. The three along the top are status quo, that's the ELF system, and the three along the bottom are the PPT 2020 regime. The first point to note on the status quo pies is you'll see there is no BP take at $20, but the take does increase as we go through price, and at $60, yes, the industry is the industry take is higher than the state's take, which is clearly.
Senator French, I didn't mean to cut you off in your mid-sentence. I was. Yeah.
That's okay.
I know it's getting late. How do you, you've seen the administration's presentations on their view of PPT and Dr. Van Muir's numbers, and I'm looking at a Department of Revenue chart that shows that at $20 a barrel, your profit margin is about 22%. Now, maybe now that's industry-wide, not BP-centric. But I can you reconcile those two? You know, your representation that you're making no money versus the administration's representation that the industry is making 22%, or are those two numbers just completely irreconcilable?
Mr. Chairman, Senator French, it may be something we have to reconcile outside the room, but I guess that obviously I don't have the benefit of looking at the data that you're looking at, but we ought to check whether or not they're including capital depreciation, which is a key element in the profit calculation. And if they're not including capital depreciation, they may be understating the point at which we go negative.
Thank you.
Senator Stebbins.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. If I could, and I certainly appreciate your guys' presentation this evening and time, could we get the percentage breakdowns on the pie pieces, the pie charts here on page 15?
Yes, certainly. Yeah, we're very happy to provide them. Save you measuring them.
Yeah, well, yes. The more we work into this whole process and the more questions we have, and certainly we're going to have more questions for our consultants than they probably thought we were going to have.
And if we move down and look at the PPT regime, at low prices, we make a very small profit, but we do make a profit. And then at medium to high prices, BP share increases until you get to $60, where we see that the BP and state share is balanced. In fact, coincidentally, works out to be the same. So we see the effect of PPT in action here. Basically giving us slightly more at low prices, but squeezing significantly our profit margin at high prices. And that's just the nature of the calculation and the way the system's been designed.
What do you think happens $100?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
What do you think happens at $100? Because whatever system we go to, I'm an advocate that we run just ridiculously high numbers and ridiculously low numbers through it, so that we try as best we can to anticipate where we might be 15, 20 years from now, or who knows, one Gulf War away.
I think by definition it would probably be pretty close to the same, but to be honest, we haven't run numbers at $100. Okay. The final thought I'd like to leave with you with tonight is in Dr. Van Meers's material. He talks a lot about the impact of the impact of PPT on the rate of return of incremental projects. So we did want to set the record straight that we as investors do look at rate of return. It's an important measure, but we also look at other economic metrics, including net present value and total cash. And clearly, if it goes without saying that if we are paying higher taxes, we are taking a lower total cash from any particular project. And this example just shows that in the PPT regime, what percentage of cash flow of this particular project, and this was a typical North Slope small project, what percentage of the cash flow we're left with in the PPT 2020 regime versus the status quo. But clearly, total return, total cash is an important measure, which hasn't been talked about much in the analysis done by the state's consultant. And you'll be relieved to know we come to our final slide, and we'll just leave you with our key conclusions. The first being that decline is a problem, and it's a problem that we share, and we'd all like to find a solution to it. And we believe that Alaska has been on decline because profitability has been insufficient to attract the capital, not due to the lack of resource. There is a huge resource there, but it is a challenged resource, and it's going to need some help to get it developed. Large increases in investment are required to stem the ongoing decline, and tens of billions of dollars, possibly between 50 and 100 billion dollars, will be required to invest in the Alaska business. and therefore PPT must work for the major oil companies as well as the new entrants. I think Ray has demonstrated that the capital is mobile, and it will move around the world to those investments and those basins where it can earn a profit. Profit-based taxes are superior to revenue-based taxes. We do believe the PPT structure has merit, and it could serve Alaska and the industry well for a very long time to come, but clearly the numbers have to be right. And key thesis is that higher taxes means less investment, and we would advocate that the 20% tax rate will not maximize investment and production from the ANS. And our final thought is that oil needs gas and gas needs oil. For gas to work, we need a healthy oil business, and we need a healthy oil business that's going to be there for another 40 or 50 years to underpin gas. So with that, I would end my remarks and just say thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify. And obviously BP will be happy to testify on an ongoing basis as you continue your deliberations.
Thank you very much, Senator
Stedman.
Yes. I keep on saying Senator Burt.
That's okay. I think we all know that capital is mobile and it, you know, flows around the world. And the last couple of years, hasn't there been kind of a real active movement worldwide to increase government take in some areas substantially? And as that curve moves up, the government take percentage moves up around the world. Everything else being equal, wouldn't that help Alaska get capital directed this direction versus
the other? I'll let Ray answer that.
Okay. Yes, I mean, you're right. There have been some changes in a number of fiscal regimes around the world, but it's not universal. It's a bit patchy. Some regimes have changed, others haven't. I mean, I think it's important that a long-term view is taken. Most governments try to take a long-term view here. I mean, after all, it's only 6 years ago the oil price was $10, and at the time people thought it was going to stay there. History shows that you simply do not get sustained periods of high commodity prices. They go in cycles. So although we're benefiting from an upswing in the oil price today, I think most commentators would agree that it's not sustainable at these prices, and it will eventually go down. And if you keep changing your regime to reflect the daily, the monthly, or the yearly oil price, you will end up with a very unstable regime with continual changes.
Senator Elton, did you have a question?
Mr. Chair, I did, but I'll wait and I'll ask it when they come to me with the information on the other states and oil team. So.
Further questions? Senator Terrio.
I asked this question earlier, and actually I'm just looking at the previous presenter's information. It talks about the valuation metrics, and in the PPT, the proposed PPT, it proposes using the producer's royalty settlement agreement of DNR. It's my understanding there's three DNR, there's DOR, and there's Department of Interior, and they can vary by as much as a dollar. And it's my understanding that this is the lowest one. And just wonder what you have to say about those different valuation methodologies.
Which of the three royalty settlements with DNR is the lowest?
It's got the producer's royalty settlement agreement with DNR. I know there's a different methodology with Department of Revenue, and there's a different one yet with the Department of Interior.
Well, there are three methods, excuse me, through the chair. There are three settlements with DNR, three flavors, an ARCO flavor, a BP flavor, and a Exxon flavor. And ConocoPhillips is heir to the ARCO flavor. We have the BP flavor. Exxon has their flavor. Everybody else on the slope who has a royalty settlement has basically chosen one of those flavors. There are different methods. They don't necessarily come to exactly the same net back value either amongst themselves. All of them, however, have a provision that allows DNR to reopen the methodology that's being used to calculate that net back price, both the starting value and the West Coast. If they want to change report, instead of using Platts oilgram, they want to use Reuters, something like that, there are ways to reopen that. How you quantify the costs between Alaska and the West Coast, obviously that has to be subtracted out. One of the settlements, as I recall, uses a ratio as those costs, or did, at least for a while. Perhaps that's been reopened and closed. Others use actual costs. And then the DNR auditors or whoever, sometimes they come from DOR and do a combined tax and royalty net back audit. Wherever they come from, they would then look at the books to see what are those actual costs. The idea of the royalty summit, I think I can say where it came from. Can I without? Came from the administration. And you know, the idea of using the interior, I think, is only available if you don't have state lands. So if there's an MMS formula there and a state formula, we would use the state formula and for the production from a unit, even though there may be federal lands that's involved as well. And I don't know, I'm not an expert on the MMS netback because that is a federal royalty, and my specialty is more state taxes and the state royalty issues. Right. The point is that we're already using this methodology to report to the state. So we don't have to reinvent a wheel. The other thing is that, I think the legislation allows the Department of Revenue still to use one of those formulas, and it can modify it to adjust for the fact that it determines a net back at the wrong place, in the middle of the field or at the Christmas tree or the well, instead of at the meter where it goes into the pipeline leaving the field. There are the provisions for those types of adjustments to be made to the royalty net back. There are provisions also that the department could prescribe a formula of its own creation and use that. The point is that in this legislation right now, there is a lot of discretion as it's drafted in the Department of Revenue about what the methodology is that they would use. It authorizes then a wide variety of approaches depending on what the facts and circumstances are. From our point of view, in wanting to have a system that we understand and can report and pay and know that we've done it right, having a lot of uncertainty in terms of what the department is going to decide how in terms of doing these modifications to our royalty settlement or not modifying a royalty settlement or prescribing a formula, those create uncertainty in the system. It would be a whole lot nicer, if that uncertainty could collapse down into a single formula or a single methodology, and we each have the big, well, not just the big producers, but everybody else who has on the slope who has a settlement agreement, we all have a methodology that we know and we work with the state for royalty purposes. So that seems to us to be a reasonable approach, minimizes the need to perhaps start keeping a separate set of books for PPT purposes only. And it does have a self-correcting mechanism built in there that if as circumstances change, which is one thing you should be concerned about. And I know this because, I wrote regulations back 25 years ago, 1979 and 1980, about how you would value North Slope crude. And the one thing that surely happened is the markets changed, and what was a relevant basket of crudes to look at cease to be relevant. This has a mechanism built into it, this royalty approach, that allows for those updates to occur and be agreed upon. And that's an important mechanism that you lack in some of the other approaches, or that you may lack.
Thank you.
Further questions? Not, thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate your time. tomorrow we'll hear from the Explorers and Independents. With that, meeting's adjourned.